Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles, but we still here, finna build here. Fuck coin sale, bro.
Show. They got me started, lying hearted. I'm the new Mufasa, and I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruzu Saba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, ha. We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles, but we still here, finna build here. Fuck coin sale, bro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, shit, that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation. Black power, brothers and sisters. Black power. We apologize for being a few minutes late. We had a slight bit of technical difficulty, but we're right on track. Tonight we're going to play the last part of Part 11 of the grand jury people's investigation into the human rights violations, crimes against humanity of the COVID pandemic, and the lethal injection of the jab that is causing 93% adverse effect and death across the planet. So tonight we're going to play the final testimony. Black power.
Let's see if we can dig a little deeper. Let's hear what Matthew Arad has to say.
Yes, thank you for inviting me onto this esteemed panel, and thank you, Patrick, for going through that very important briefing. Just keying off of some of the elements of what you touched upon, and I know that the time is very much limited. I'll try my very best to keep it within 20 minutes, as we discussed. the figure of Maurice Strong amidst this entire thing is, I think, a very interesting introduction for a lot of people. It's a figure who, in many ways, was the godfather of the modern Green New Deal, the thing that is behind or integrated with the Agenda 2030, the farm-to-fork program to try to bring in a Monsanto GMO program for Europe as part of a decarbonization strategy, which is also tied to a variety of other insane policies. When you actually look at a lot of what these governments of the transatlantic are being told they have to do in order to decarbonize, according to these computer models that say we simply must do this by 2030 or 2050 in order to save nature, you're like, well, the effect will be massive death and the inability to sustain human life, let alone life in general. So either it's incompetent or there is an intention behind it to get that effect. And I would say when you look at the evidence, the intention is indeed discoverable. And people who say, oh, that's a conspiracy theories discredit you immediately. All they're saying is I've been brainwashed to think that anybody who says that intentions and ideas are causal are insane, and I must turn off my brain and stop thinking. There's been a lot of work to get people to do this. So indeed, there are intentions. You can know bad intentions, you can know bad ideas, but you have to think on a very different level than that which our system conditions us to think on. Maurice Strong was not only one of the key organizers of the Rio Summit, the Agenda 2030, he was also a co-founder of the World Economic Forum and a secretary general of the first United Nations Conference on the Environment and Population in 1972. Very important character, who was also president of the Rockefeller Foundation in his time, head of the World Bank, like one of these just key technocrats who's just installed to get things done as a sort of hitman. He said in a 1990 interview, what if the small group of world leaders were to conclude that the principal risk to the earth comes from the actions of the rich countries? And if the world is to survive, those rich countries would have to sign an agreement reducing their impact on the environment. Will they do it? I'm quoting him here. The group's conclusion is no, the rich countries won't do it. They won't change. So in order to save the planet, the group decides, isn't the only hope for the planet that the industrial civilizations collapse? Isn't it our responsibility to bring it about? And this is from West Magazine in 1990, where he says in a later interview, I think with Glenn Beck, he says, oh, but I was just talking about a fictitious book I was thinking about writing. He's literally, if you read the context of that interview, he's literally describing a World Economic Forum conference that is taking place, and this is something he's musing upon. And again, I think when you look at his actions, what he was a part of, also as a vice president of the World Wildlife Fund under Prince Philip for several years, and a variety of things. His whole life's devotion has been to getting institutions and practices in place that actually accomplish exactly what he's saying right there in that statement. I put together a few slides with a few quotes that I would like to share right now to get across the nature of eugenics. I might have to blast through this a little faster than I would want to, but whatever. So how the unthinkable became thinkable, behind it is an image from a 1930s pro-eugenics propaganda poster called Release the Stranglehold of Hereditary Disease and Unfitness. Who determines what unfitness is that's what people don't like talking about. This is a big deal. Eugenics was the science of population control and selective breeding to create, as Patrick pointed out, a new race, an Ubermensch race, kind of like an Achaean Superman, that would take the reins, the helm of the chaotic flow of evolution into a controlled, scientifically managed way, while breeding out the unfit, those who are undesirable. Usually you'll find many of these people like Margaret Sanger, Planned Parenthood, the Eugenic Society of Britain and America. They usually tend to focus on the darker skinned races, but of course they're not discriminatory overall when it comes to killing off the unfit. The context in which eugenics as a science, which I'll go into, came about is important. At the end of the 19th century, there was a very strong scientific and cultural optimism that was alive and spreading around the idea that the human mind was a natural phenomenon, the thing that causes us to make discoveries and translate those discoveries into new technologies that benefit and improve the quality of life of citizens and also of nature by greening deserts, for example. This was an idea that was a very strong paradigm, but certain imperialists didn't agree with it because they viewed there's a fact of overpopulation. Overpopulation always happens, but why is today's population constraints different from what it was 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago? It's this question of scientific and technological progress. The two approaches to deal with population crises when people exceed the ability to support those people is to either, one, do what the British Empire had already been doing before the days of eugenics, which is simply induce artificial wars, induce famines, induce disease, whatever the case may be. And there on the left is a picture of some of the terrible effects of British imperial policy in India. Controlled starvations, again, was a part of the British imperial game as a one-world empire that was dominant throughout the 19th century and even 18th century. What they did to the Irish in the potato famine is another example of that, and that was done under an idea of a scientifically managed system using certain mathematical, what they thought were mathematical principles of population control. The other way of dealing with excess population is not killing people to satisfy the limit, but rather encourage, as I said, new discoveries. This is an image, an etching from the 1876 centennial celebration in the United States in Philadelphia, celebrating the new discoveries that were emerging and spreading from the United States to Germany, Russia, and beyond, countries adopting protectionism, long-term credit, and the idea, again, of defining economics not around worshiping money, but rather uplifting people from squalor and giving people, creating new sources of wealth by doing this, new inventions, new discoveries. So again, the Malthusian, the term Malthus, or Malthusianism, which is what Maurice Strong helped revive in the early 70s, late 60s, came from the simplistic theories of a British East India Company economist who taught at the British Empire's Haileybury College, training generations of imperial economists, Thomas Malthus. And he observed that population grows arithmetically, food production grows people grow geometrically on average, while food production only grows arithmetically, and thus social engineers can forecast using mathematical formulas where you will have a population crisis and then act preemptively, as Malthus even describes in gut-wrenching detail in his 1799 Essays on the Principle of Population, to encourage the death of the useless, of the poor, even babies who are deemed unfit. That he says the parishes should stop supporting to make way for other, anyway, it's gory. And he has prescriptions on doing that, and it is done. The idea is always that the nature and resources are relatively limited. You cannot create new resources. He does not factor in the quality of the human mind to transform and upshift the environment by introducing a new discovery like electricity. That doesn't exist in his equations. That's actually disruptive to his equations. This is added to by people like John Stuart Mill, who includes the idea of the diminishing rate of returns. That system is just, human economies are just constantly in tension where the strong are and the most fit are better able to control the diminishing rates of returns while the weak are subdued by the strong, the imperialists. Charles Darwin, in his autobiography, you know, people wonder, where does this theory of natural selection come from that was then applied by the eugenicists on a social scale, the thing that described the fossil records and the flow of life in evolution. So the Darwinian interpretation of evolution, his model of natural selection, he got, as he describes in his autobiography, by reading, he says, in 1838, 15 months after I had begun my systematic inquiry, I had happened to read for amusement Malthus on population and being prepared to appreciate the struggle for existence, which everywhere goes on, from long-continued observation of the habits of animals and plants, it at once struck me that under these circumstances, favorable variations would tend to be preserved and unfavorable ones to be destroyed. The result would be the formation of a new species. Here, then, I had at last got a theory by which to work. Charles Darwin. So Darwin is saying that this is the source of his discovery of the mechanism of what causes these creative mutations to introduce new qualities in species, defined around an idea of, number one, randomness, that ultimately the mutations are absolutely random and thus unknowable by virtue of their randomness. Number two, gradualism, that there are no creative leaps in the that are possible. And indeed, that's a problem because in the fossil records, we don't see gradualism. We see, in fact, a lot of creative leaps, much as we see with human economies and human societies introducing new ideas. You don't have a gradual, you don't gradually come to a new discovery. You have it in a eureka flash. And the effect is, when you apply it, an ability to, as a quantum leap, sustain much more people at a higher quality of life. If you have a certain type of society that is not based upon this disgusting view of human beings as sort of just talking cattle. Coming out of this, Darwin's cousin, Francis Galton, is somebody who converts Darwin. Darwin at first has a problem with the application socially of his views into the science of eugenics, but Darwin later writes to Galton saying, "You've made a disciple out of me." And Galton is a fellow, basically says, okay, using the Mendelian science of genetics, using certain Malthusian concepts of population growth, we can now formulate the queen of all sciences, the best of all social sciences. And he says in 1904, eugenics must be introduced into the national conscience like a new religion. It has indeed strong claims to become an orthodox religious tenet for the future. For eugenics cooperate with the workings of nature by securing that humanity shall be represented by the fittest races. I see no impossibility in eugenics becoming a religious dogma among mankind. And this is so important that this was always the design and the intention, even when Thomas Huxley was organizing the X Club, of which Darwin was a fundamental part in his theories. The idea was in 1865 with this X Club, around which Galton later emerged, was to take representatives of all branches of sciences, mathematics, biology, astronomy, sociology, and unify them into trying to create a unified science around mathematics and imposing a mathematical cage of description upon all branches of science, giving it sort of an appearance of science, but no more discoveries, because real discoveries happen when you press upon the limits of the unknown beyond which mathematics, the language of mathematics that is always evolving, cannot venture, right? Mathematics is useful, but it's like a language that changes in conformity with our discoveries of the laws of the universe. There's no end to that process. So they wanted to basically take that relationship and put mathematics in the dominant position where people's minds would say, oh, if the mathematics that already exists doesn't describe it, I can't know it, and you shouldn't know it either. And this is something which, again, Thomas Huxley was assigned to do. This is what Galton, with his idea of a queen of all sciences, the new religion, was driving towards. And it did become, in many ways, a dominant science of all sciences. Between up until World War II, we had 32 American states, starting with Indiana in 1907, adopt eugenics policies of sterilizing the unfit. Two Canadian provinces, BC and Alberta, thousands of people were sterilized based upon what? A statistical probabilistic science. It was fundamentally statistical that if your mother, your grandfather, your great-grandfather had low IQs or had a criminal record, they would say, oh, it is statistically likely that your children or unborn grandchildren will also have low IQs or criminal tendencies. And thus, using that statistical probability, we can preemptively now sterilize you and justify it scientifically. And that was part of what drove, again, all of these things to happen before Germany, before Ernst Rudin, who also received Rockefeller funding and Macy Foundation funding to do this eugenic science in Germany. It just so happened that Germany had a political type of government funded, again, by Wall Street and London financiers that was very good at bypassing those democratic protocols that would normally be resistant to that type of embrace of something so anti-human as eugenics and the breeding out of the unfit, which didn't just target Jews, right? Poles, unfit Germans, people know the horrors of the Nazi T4 program that killed hundreds of thousands of Germans who were deemed just to be not worthy of life. They were too expensive to maintain. So when the Nazi machine, that Frankenstein monster, blew up and collapsed, there was a need to reorganize. Those who actually brought us fascism and eugenics were never punished in Nuremberg, and that's very important. So among those figures who was assigned the task of reorganizing the grand strategy for recapturing nations that had just defeated fascism in the post-World War II era. We have none other than Sir Thomas Huxley's grandson, Sir Julian Huxley, who becomes the creator of UNESCO, the United Nations Education, Science, and Cultural Organization, where he writes in its manifesto that the moral for UNESCO is clear. The task laid upon it of promoting peace and security can never be wholly realized through the means assigned to it, education, science, and culture. It must envisage some form of world political unity, whether through a single world government or otherwise, as the only certain means of avoiding war. Of course, they don't say that it is his, you know, Anglo-American oligarchical networks that funded the war to begin with, which never should have happened. They all treat it like, oh, no, the war was a natural consequence of having sovereign nation states. That's what they just naturally, in a Darwinian fight for survival, they are wired to want more and suppress weaker nations and impose their hegemony. That's the nature of man. That's the nature of nation states. And thus, we need a solution. Now, of course, again, they always avoid the fact that you have these financiers from J.P. Morgan, the Brown Brothers, Harriman banking houses funding these things and assassinating leaders who are not to their liking artificially to bring about these political effects. So they don't talk about that. But then they say, like he does, as the only means of avoiding war, we need a single world government. In its educational program, it can stress the ultimate need for a world political unity and familiarize all peoples with the implications of the transfer of full sovereignty from separate nations to a world organization, all for peace, of course. And keep in mind, he's also the head of the Eugenics Society. He's not just, just the head of UNESCO. He is the president of the Eugenics Society of Britain, which becomes later on the Galton Foundation, by the way, very much today integrated with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and Gavi. Whitney Webb goes through this in her impeccable research. But he says a little bit later on, still in that same founding document, that at the moment it is probable that the indirect effect of civilization is dysgenic, instead of eugenic, that is getting worse instead of getting better genetically. And in any case, it seems likely that the dead weight of genetic stupidity, physical weakness, mental instability, and disease proneness, which already exist in the human species, will prove too great a burden for real progress to be achieved. Thus, even though it is quite true that any radical eugenic policy will be for many years politically and psychologically impossible, that is because people got to see the effects of it, you know, once Hitler lost and people got to see globally what the logical consequence of doing this really is, and they were naturally horrified, so their minds were being a respectable science. So it is psychologically impossible for many years. It will be important for UNESCO to see that the eugenic problem is examined with the greatest care, and that the public mind is informed on the issues at stake so that much that it is now unthinkable may at least become thinkable. And so the question then becomes, what did he do? In what way does he repackage eugenics and call it something else to get similar, the same effects as were desired by those leading Thule Society Nazis and their London and Wall Street financiers? So let's look at some of the key points of what he does. Keep in mind, all the way up until 1962, he is the president of the British Eugenics Society. 1962. 1947, he founds the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, the world's biggest, most powerful conservation organization that is designed to shift the values of society. In also 1947, he helps set up with Brock Kisholm, a Tavistockian Canadian psychiatrist, the World Health Organization. Kisholm is a devout world governmentalist. He writes about it. He calls for the need to cleanse society of the belief in family or nation state and religion. He thinks that that's the cause of mental unhealth. And he says that one quote I just picked out from Kisholm is the reinterpretation and eventual eradication of the concept of right and wrong, which has been the basis of child training, the substitution of intelligent and rational thinking, scientific thinking, for faith in the certainties of old people. These are the belated objectives of practically all effective psychotherapy. Basically, he's saying that real psychotherapy, the purpose of the science of mind going forward, and mental health should be to liberate us from the belief in right and wrong and the traditions of old people that are obsolete in favor of logical thinking. So this is part of a atomization program of the baby boomer generation, especially who are targeted, those growing up after World War II, who are going to be subjected to a new type of conditioning, a new type of educational and cultural experience that will detach them, their identities, from these broader problems of nation state, religion, religious and cultural heritage. That makes them more easy to predict, and you know that they will tend to do things that are predictable, like herd themselves into groupthink more easily instead of stand on their own. Later on, Julian Huxley co-terms the science of transhumanism, gives it that label, and around that there's an idea of a cybernetic scientific management of society around certain ideas that emerged after World War II. He then goes on and co-founds the World Wildlife Fund for Nature. Remember that organization that I mentioned, Maury Strong, was also vice president of, alongside Prince Philip and Prince Bernhard, two devout Malthusians. Now, the new ethical paradigm, as I write here, it moves from the fringe increasingly into the mainstream, designed around the shifting of saving nature, basically saying that instead of having an ethic of saving humanity from empire and slavery and scarcity, no. That's the old wisdom. The new wisdom will be saving nature from humanity. The way that they do this, utilizing the development of digital binary computer systems and modeling, is to try to say, okay, we're going to assume that all of ecology, all of humanity, and even all of the universe, cosmology even, is going to be something you could chart using linear systems in computer models, using very simplified variables that will then allow us to predict everything that will ever happen and everything that could ever happen, with presumed assumptions like the natural state being equilibrium, stasis, no change. That is what they said is now natural. So this is an example on the left and on the right. We already saw the Malthusian population model. This is the Limits to Growth Club of Rome neo-Malthusian model that emerged out of the MIT studies of Forrester and Meadows, funded by the Club of Rome, and Canadian funding under Pierre Elliott Trudeau, actually, that basically just added a few more variables but still justified the same thing, that every time you have more people, you have more pollution and thus more problems, more destroyed environment, and thus the enlightened social engineers should always, to scientifically manage society, ensure that populations are as natural as the unchanging environment, so that we have to, if we're overpopulated, we have to constrict that population to something of what became called carrying capacity, that the mathematical carrying capacity of what exists now is all that could exist, is all that we should permit. And thus, new discoveries also became problematic, discoveries in the atom, discoveries in space technology, discoveries that actually solve and cure problems, those became things that would cause disequilibrium, because you haven't, those who have monopolized those fixed resources and fixed sets of formulas and discoveries, they haven't monopolized that which has not yet existed. So every time you introduce a new discovery or a new resource, it changes everything. It upsets this perfect supposed balance that their mathematical models demand exist. So this is where you get a lot of scientists being killed, a lot of scientific research being subverted, the defunding of nuclear fusion, the defunding of space, of Apollo, its canceling and beyond. But just to get across, these people don't really care about the environment. They don't really care about pollution. And when you look at one of the co-founders of the Club of Rome, Sir Alexander King, who also brought in cybernetics and art information systems theory into the OECD while he was managing that. This was also brought into NATO earlier as a new system of control, a science of control, which I don't have time to go into. But he basically admits it in 1991. He says, in searching for a new enemy to unite us, describing the origins of the Club of Rome and the models we just saw above there, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill. All these dangers are caused by human intervention, and it is only through changed attitudes and behavior that they can be overcome. Then he lets the cat out of the bag. The real enemy then is humanity itself. So the real issue was that these things, they don't really care about pollution or preserving the environment. They don't. It's really that whenever human beings apply scientific and technological progress to improve our conditions and overcome the limits to our growth in a lawful way by building, let's say, a hydroelectric dam or some other piece of vital infrastructure, it changes ecosystems. Yes, it changes it. But does that mean that it is intrinsically unnatural? Not intrinsically. Of course, human beings can do destruction to nature. I'm not saying they can't. But what they're saying is that it is intrinsically unnatural. The human mind is not natural because the human mind causes these nonlinear changes. So these are people worshiping at the altar of a mathematical religion, as Galton said. It's really that. One of the last big quote, and then I'll stop. just as it's important. But John Holdren, who became the science czar under Obama, that's a picture of John Holdren right there in the background with Biden and Obama. He was the science czar of the United States for several years. He co-wrote a book with Paul Ehrlich, the fellow who popularized the population bomb utilizing the Club of Rome models in the 60s and 70s. He was his student. So in Ecoscience, Population, Resources, and the Environment, John Holdren writes the big behemoth of a book, over 1,000 pages, and it's hard to read, but there's some disgusting things like this that pop out. But he describes, he muses now, 1977. Perhaps these agencies, combined with the United Nations Environmental Protection Agency, created by Maurice Strong, by the way, and the United Nations Population Agencies, created by Maurice Strong, by the way, might eventually be developed into a planetary regime, sort of an international super-agency for population, resources, and environment. Such a comprehensive planetary regime could control the development, administration, conservation, and distribution of all natural resources, renewable or non-renewable, at least insofar as international implications exist. Thus, the regime could have the power to control pollution, not only in the atmosphere and oceans, but also in such freshwater bodies as rivers and lakes that cross international boundaries or that discharge into oceans. The regime might also be a logical central agency for regulating all international trade, perhaps including assistance from developed countries to lesser developed countries, and including all food on the international market, so controlling the food too. Why not? The planetary regime might be given responsibility for determining the optimum population for the world and for each region and for arbitrating various countries' shares within their regional limits. Control of population size must remain the responsibility of each government, but the regime would have some power to enforce the agreed-upon limits, of course. You can't just have the COP26 agreements there as a nice thing that people sign on to. You need to have some enforcement procedures, don't you, is what we're told by those who are managing things like the Green New Deal or COP26 or the Paris Accords. So you definitely have right now a very misanthropic grouping, an ideology, which has a religious nature to it, committed to, as Patrick pointed out, a fear, I think, ultimately of their own mortality. There's, I think, a certain inability. Human beings that become mature grapple and deal with the fact that we all die. We're all finite, right? We have certain qualities where within our soul, within our mind, we can tap into and discover universal laws and universal principles of nature that are beyond the world of limitations, justice, freedom, gravity. I mean, things that are equality. And that as an idea is not something you can cut in half, right? I can't cut justice in half and put it in my pocket. It has no beginning or end. So this is something that the human mind, when it's functioning with reason and conscience together as a matured sovereign being, we can tap into these eternal qualities. But our bodies and our brains physically still have weight. They still perish. There's a before and an after. And so you come to terms with that reality of our finiteness, but our infiniteness, that we leave something behind. We get something from the past generations, from thousands of years ago, and we can leave something behind in various degrees to those who are to come after us. And that's the best way to satisfy our happiness and our purpose for being. And the founding fathers who initiated who risked their lives for this idea of the United States, right, of a republic founded upon the consent of the governed and the inalienable rights of all people. This is very anti-Darwinian. It is against the idea of their personal survival. It was something that scared the hell out of this oligarchy, and always has and still does, as it represents a proof that the oligarchy's very fundamental system itself is wrong, that humans can do that, and we can make these quantum leaps that are not gradualistic, it's not random. It is tied to a certain belief and faith in a design, but it's not one that is predeterministic. It allows free will. It allows beauty. This is something, again, that is at the center, I believe, of the fight then and still is today. They are afraid of that. They all do want to ultimately upload their soul, whatever their being, into some digital cloud to overcome their own fear of death, I think, ultimately. And they've built an entire religion around that, masquerading as science, and a political structure around that as well, masquerading as democracy, but it's obviously not. So we're now a situation where the consequences of World War II were not ended in 1945 at Nuremberg. We have still the same type of institutions with a new repackaged ideology. Again, it takes on different forms. It's still just as evil, and it's still just as wrong, scientifically, morally so. And I think humanity right now is going to face a test on whether or not we can overcome this using those God-given powers of creativity and morality, and do it in a coherent way, along with other countries that don't want to be sacrificed on the altar of Gaia today, which is the current plan. And I think everything going on around Ukraine, around the attempt to militarily encircle Russia and China, erect a new Iron Curtain, separating East and West, I think has a lot to do with the fear of civilizational powers that don't want to sacrifice their ancient traditions on this religious altar today. So that's where I guess, just ended. And I know I might have gone a few minutes longer than I wanted to, and I'm sorry.
Thank you very much, Matthew. That was very instructive, and it builds perfectly on what Patrick ended with. Esteemed colleagues, any questions?
Thank you, Matthew. You have given us some very, very good insight. I think for me, what definitely stands out when it comes to your evidence that you have given today is that you have made a connection with the World Economic Forum, and you've made a connection as well with the World Health Organization as well. So when it comes to the World Health Organization, that is then where we need to focus specifically on Julian Huxley. Your evidence is, and you can just say as to whether I've actually captured it correctly, that Julian Huxley was one of the co-founders of the World Health Organization. That's what you've said. Is that correct?
He helped set it up, and together he, through UNESCO as well as the World Health Organization, co-set up as well the World Federation of Mental Health in 1948 with another Tavistockian psychopath called a psychiatrist called John Rawlings Rees, who was, again, a fanatic world government depopulationist who called for psychiatric shock troops to be installed in different government bureaucracies to redefine global society and rewire its values. And he's very gut-wrenchingly clear. But yes, Julian Huxley did play a very important role organizing the creation of the World Health Organization.
Okay. So will you then say that when it comes to the World Health Organization and specifically the role that he played, with a setup or the influence regarding the setup of the World Health Organization, will you say then that his ideologies, he basically transplanted it into the World Health Organization, specifically when it comes to his eugenic dogmas?
I think based upon the writings, the work of G. Brock Kissholm, who has extensive comments about what his view of mental health and real health should be, and also political structures to enforce that, I think you can very much make it clear, also based on the policies and actions of the World Health Organization, what approaches to funding health science were engaged upon over the 1960s, 70s. Yes. There does still seem to be more work. There are not as many smoking guns as I would like so far in my research, tying Julian Huxley directly to the helm of each of these policy actions. So you have to sort of take a step back and look at it a bit more dynamically. There are some, but not as many as one would like to take it to court in that sense. So I think you have to approach it in a slightly different way.
Okay, this is exactly as to where I wanted us to go to, is that yes, he was instrumental in the setup of the World Health Organization, but now it is a matter based on your research, where one actually needs to go into quite some depth when it comes to his influence and see as to whether that golden thread has been kept as a vision or a mission statement, and is it currently still that vision and mission statement. For if it is, then obviously we can then come to the conclusion that the World Health Organization, the fundamental is eugenics, is basically a genocide in a sense.
Well, what I would say, and I think this is valuable to look at it this way, is that the science of information systems theory, which was what was applied, sometimes it's called cybernetics, was applied to every single domain possible of human knowledge, biology, health science, ecology, everything, and also human economy. The idea was to over-bureaucratize every possible system and compartmentalize it into small, tiny, specialized and subspecialized domains with only a small grouping called the helmsman, a small executive that were permitted to see what the whole was doing so that most people would be not able to see what it was that they were a part of. This was done intensely in the creation of the big pharmaceutical complexes in the early 70s. The policy papers, the scientific justification for this rewiring, what was the World Health Organization playing a very big role in this, and things like the Whitehead Institute, the Broad Institute, all of these different organizations that became leaders in genetic manipulation of food, of everything, and especially in the terms of the genetic coding, were all coming out of these complexes. So that when you look at people like Eric Lander, who is the Rhodes Scholar czar of science under Biden up until just a few weeks ago, he's been a close friend of John Holdren, and he was the father of the Human Genome Project, which always had at its heart the intention to sequence the human genome in order to modify the human species in terms of things like CRISPR. So there are people coming out of the big conference in 2015 that announced CRISPR, who said, people like David Baltimore, who is his friend and president of the Whitehead Institute, that we have now made the unthinkable become thinkable. We now can control the programming of DNA of the species and direct it towards an organized direction. So it is very eugenics-based, and there's so many ways you could look at it, but I think that for me, that's the approach I would take, and also the environmental dynamic that Julian Huxley spearheaded to with Maurice Strong. I think that has a lot of value. If you want to really bring something to a court and prove its invalidity on a variety of levels, that's another fruitful approach to take.
Okay. My last question to you is that the evidence that you have given when it comes to the nature of eugenics, starvation is one of the methods. So I am now thinking and I'm reflecting on Bill Gates specifically, where in a sense it is common cause because it is all over in the alternative media, where Bill Gates is one of the major or the biggest farmland owners in the United States, which means farmland comes down to food production. So will you say that when it comes to a statement like that, one of the largest or the biggest owners of farmland, and then eugenics is the nature, it is, one of the methods is starvation, can we actually draw any positive correlation between the two? I mean, he owns the farmland, a majority stake of the farmland in the United States.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, this is part and parcel of this Green New Deal, Build Back Better for the World, insane agenda of trying to have like 30% of the world's surface area off limits to all human development by 2030. That's part of the 30-30 agenda, including both the United States, which it's embedded in, Biden signed an executive order calling for that. It requires the cooperation of private organizations like Bill Gates's to buy up the farmland and then bring big chunks of it off limits to actual food production, or just simply enforce artificial modes of genetically modified produce that is beneficial to the elites so-called wannabe elites. They have the same thing for Africa and beyond. Part of it as well is to take farmland out of farm use and put it into windmills and solar panels, which require extensive amounts of land area. That is also what they're doing already across Europe and across North America. They're paying farmers to kill their cattle and to not plow their or till their soil so that they could get money in by putting up windmills and solar panels, which themselves are very, very inefficient forms of energy sources that will cause new constraints onto our ability to support our people on the earth. And that is part of the design as well. And that's scientifically proven that the energy return on investment of these things is so low that you will not be able to support life in an industrially advanced civilization where you would expect to live 80 years of age on average. You cannot do that. And that's the effect.
Thank you very much, Mitch.
Matthew, in concluding, if we look at the totality of the evidence, as you described it to us and as Patrick gave it to us, we see that the influence of Julian Huxley, even not just on UNESCO, but also on the World Health Organization, is still there. We see that someone like Bill Gates, whose family has a eugenics background, has a very strong influence in the World Health Organization today. If you look at everything that we've discussed, would you say that eugenics plays a big role in today's World Health Organization?
Oh, yes, most certainly, absolutely. And I mean, I know Whitney did not get a chance to speak today. She had an emergency, but I know that in her research, she's gone through that very well on a variety of levels. That, you know, things like the Engender Health, is which was formerly the Sterilization League for Human Betterment, is deeply, it changed its name, but it's a deep embedded part of USAID and the Gates Foundation, as is the Galton Institute, which had just changed its name from the Eugenics Society, which are, again, embedded into Gavi and the Gates. You know, Gates' own father, Robert Gates Sr., Bill Gates Sr., was the head of Planned Parenthood. That Margaret Sanger, who was a devout eugenicist and racist, had pushed in that's where it came out of, was the American Eugenic Societies. There's no evidence that I've seen that their MO has changed based upon the effects of creating crises in population, war, starvation artificially over the past 60 years especially, even though we've been told, oh, globalization will feed the world and give everybody a home and all this great stuff and we'll have free trade together and everybody will be happy. No, the effect was debt, slavery, massive war, depopulation, and yeah, I think that is truly the case.
Thank you very much, Matthew. I know that Ilana Rachel Daniel is under some time constraints, so I would like to once again thank you very much. This was very, very enlightening, horrific in part, but we have to see the enemy directly in the eye. We have to look them directly in the eye, and that is very, very helpful what you said here. Thank you again, Matthew.
Thanks for having me on.
Ilana, did you hear what Matthew said, and did you have a chance to hear what Patrick said?
Yes, I did. I heard them both.
So what do you make of this in the current situation in Israel?
Well, it actually leads up perfect to the things that I want to say. And I'll start from the beginning, as much as you can go, the pre-COVID days here in the past 2 years. What's imperative to understanding of how all that's happened in the past 2 years happened in Israel first is to first understand the backdrop of Israel prior to COVID-19. This is a country that not only has been in a state of emergency since its modern inception, having experienced war after war and regular attack on every front, but one that's given of itself husbands, sons, and daughters to keep this homeland intact. Not only is this country used to snapping into action when duty and generals call, there's a unique Jewish experience of having been persecuted throughout history and country, culminating in the systematic annihilation of 6 million Jewish souls and the millions of others deemed undesirable. to have with Israel the mixture of the historical, ideological, theological, spiritual, and actual lived hope and trust that's placed in our government, to finally be in a supposed safe space for the Jewish nation, to flourish without prejudice. At least that was the plan as far as the flesh and blood body of this new old state understood it. We, the people of Israel, bought the brochure. We gave of ourselves and made sacrifices for a collective that's been mined and abused by its government. The Jewish people have historically served the world as the canary in the coal mine. We act as a reflection. When it's bad with and within us, that's a sign of where there's brokenness in the world. We know and have seen repeatedly whatever adversity that starts with the Jewish people never ends with them, but is a fire that spreads to consume all of us. And there's a good reason that all eyes are on Jerusalem. We're not in that coal mine alone. And we, the people of this earth, do have an opportunity now in the face of the profound losses to see each other without the nudging and blinders and guidelines that powers that be would have us believe about one another. So with the background of some of the harshest lockdowns to date, at least at the time, the first which tethered us to 100 meters from the home, only one of three countries to enforce outdoor mask mandates, we were also the first, one of the few to shut down our airports and create an open air ghetto. And security bracelets were on offer to rent to surveil the movement of the returned traveler instead of police. You have this unique background of trust in government and essentially captured audience of citizens who receives this equally captured news and is the only one to do so in Hebrew. In the most exquisite of betrayals, then Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in December 2020 informed, and I do mean informed, the country on national television that we would all be vaccinated by March. And then he proceeded to do all in his power to make good on that declaration. So what later followed was the revelation that there was an already signed and sealed contract between Pfizer and Israel. Pfizer, as we know, is an unconscionable, multiple times convicted felon of a pharmaceutical company whose roots branch back to Wyeth, who was once American Home Products, which was a subsidiary of Sterling, whereas Sterling and Bayer bought into one another's companies, and of course Bayer was originally IG Farben of Auschwitz. Pfizer had too chosen this people once again for its thorough and digitized health records on its citizens reaching back decades, its small, near hermetically sealed environment, and its eager to please government medical officials. The contract, of course, was made without any prior notification, public discourse, or put to any sort of vote as one would expect from alleged democracy. To this day, only a heavily redacted version of this contract has ever been shown to the public, one where we paid some 2.5 times the price per vial than do other countries, and allegedly leaves us beholden to Pfizer's penalty clauses, restrictions, and relative exclusivity. In a further mockery of democracy, the Corona Committee minutes, those which determine the ever-changing policy we continue to be subjected to, have been withheld from the public and classified as top secret in a 30-year confidentiality act. The state was quoted as saying, quote, the public's right to know isn't absolute. The Corona Committee recently made headlines again as it was revealed that on a panel of some 90 experts, less than half were doctors, 16 lacked any relevant clinical experience. Another 15 were a combination of senior clerks in healthcare, spokesmen, veterinarians, and communication researchers. But what's interesting is the 26 remaining identities, nearly a third, who continue to be concealed because of their positions in security and bioresearch. What ensued with the operation to inject as many Israelis en masse as possible with this novel technology for the first time ever was not only a breach of the Nuremberg Codes that were a result of the torture of human testing on this very people, but irrefutably violated the most basic tenets of first do no harm and informed consent. Informed consent is, maybe was, the foundation of modern medicine. It's the answer to the unimpeded atrocities of the Holocaust and the conclusion of the Nuremberg trials and their subsequent codification. Informed consent is defined as, I quote, the process in which a healthcare provider educates a patient about the risks, benefits, and alternatives of a given procedure or intervention and originates from the patient's right to direct what happens to their body. The patient must be competent to make a voluntary decision, and the documentation of the process is an essential element. Informed consent is both an ethical and legal obligation of medical practitioners. Israelis were not given informed consent. They were without inquiry of medical background or explanation of the gene treatment they were about to receive, injected and sat for 15 minutes at best before sent on their way. No list of potential side effects were given to look out for, nor any healthcare provider number was offered to call in case something should go amiss post-shot. Injections were given at breakneck speed, plummeting through the population from the elderly to within weeks to the next and the next down the allotted age range. And in reality, anyone accompanying someone older was often permitted to receive the jab as well so it wouldn't go to waste at the end of the day. Israelis were barraged from the outset with a campaign of fear, coercion, threats, and incitement that only worsened with the change of government to PM Naftali Bennett, who's been quoted with such gems as when echoing U.S. President Biden, proclaiming his tolerance for the unvaccinated has run out, or on another occasion how he wanted parents to fight among themselves into compliance. He's asked neighbor to encourage neighbor to do their civic duty, and he's breached the sanctity of the parent-child relationship several times, going onto national television, directly addressing our youth to go and get jabbed, lest he be forced to restrict their summer fun. And that was just within the first weeks and months of his premiership. The aggressive marketing of the old cult motto, safe and effective, included even outright lies. Like in February 2021, when Netanyahu made a video that directly stated the shot was FDA approved, well before that dubious approval was actually given. And this perpetual media campaign assaulted the singular facts we knew to be true throughout the entirety of corona narrative, which is that here, as with most infections, the elderly and those with comorbidity are disproportionately at risk, while the young have none. So in crude fashion, we saw on repeat in the days prior to the next targeted age group, the media would carpet bomb channels with overnight and first time ever frenzied stories of hospitalizations and dire health consequences, first to pregnant women, then later for 16-year-old youth, then 12-year-olds, and then passing another point of no return to our 5-year-old children. Healthy young kids who may have already had and recovered from a COVID infection in the full year's time prior, with the whole of their lives ahead of them, were made to believe they had to rush and take a still-in-its trial technology into their cellular system without a single existing long-term safety data. No system was initially installed to record post-adverse events. And only recently and rather belatedly has such a database been set up, and to this day its existence is all but unknown to the public at large. It's only been with the heroic efforts of Nakim.org, the Israel's People Committee, and Avital Livni's Testimonials Project that any chinks in Israel's happily ever after narrative were even seen. In fact, and now rather infamously, when the Ministry of Health posted on Facebook that the booster seemed to be altogether safe and effective, they received upwards of 27,000 comments from Israelis describing catastrophic reports of the harm or death incurred post-injection, themselves, friends, and relatives, some of them posting documentation to prove it. And the Ministry of Health fully panicked, disabled translation into English, and began deleting those comments, claiming they were foul language. But many were saved in any case on screenshots, which is only one aspect of the cover-up of data. We ourselves submitted a FOIA last March inquiring how many people had died post-shot, and the Ministry of Health's reply was that they did not know. There was not only no chance of recording the deluge of side effects that were all too real. Having received no informed consent, there was no understanding to the average citizen of any adverse reactions having correlated to the jab taken in the previous days, weeks, and months. And further, for those who did understand what had happened to them, the culture of incitement was so great, people genuinely feared for their relationships and livelihood should they openly call the narrative into account. I would say that in order to convince the rest of the world to roll up its collective sleeve, no knowledge of harm incurred ever could reach the public, which have left Israel's people entirely gaslit, having been subjected to human testing on one hand and denied recourse or even acknowledgement of that damage done on the other, damage that will continue to be revealed for years to come. In fact, if you look at the parts of the Pfizer-Israel contract that are visible, you will see the express goals of the research were not whatsoever to discover any safety signals or lack thereof, but as an epidemiological endeavor to test the supposed herd immunity. And of course, the concept of herd immunity here is a complete false flag. It was well known to Pfizer, Moderna, Fauci, the WHO's chief scientist, and the U.S. Surgeon General, just to name a few, this technology never had the capability to stop transmission. And as Netanyahu bought 60 million doses at the very onset for this only 9 million person population, one might conjecture he was well aware of this too. As we've yelled from the beginning, 4 doses per person, but even I didn't think it would be within only 1 year's time. With the month of January 2022 clocking more positive test results than the entirety of 2021 combined, we could probably conclude that this has been a colossal failure and close up shop. Instead, there is an open recommendation for a mind-bending 4th dose to the general population 16 years and up. This 4th dose was given to Israelis without FDA authorization or even our own completed studies in Sheba Hospital. Those Sheba Hospital studies, in fact, began only after the 4th dose rollout was initiated. And it was PM Naftali Bennett to go on television and assure us it was perfectly safe to take dose number 4 of this 3-time failed product. Bennett made his position absolutely clear when he admonished even the Ministry of Health in charges for taking too long to begin that 4th rollout. And as he stated to Davos only a few weeks ago, his method is to act fast or you might lose out. Borla was just recently, to our great embarrassment, awarded Israel's Genesis Award. And in that video announcement, in proper propagandist fashion, he's actually praised for his savvy at not taking FDA funding so that he could shorten and circumvent the bureaucracy in place for authorization. And in a display that we've entered a realm so lawless and without reason, Israel's government is again in talks with Pfizer to sign its citizens up for an Omicron vaccine trial. This while we're still beholden to the current trial that we're currently being tested upon. This, though, even mainstream media has reported that more than half of Israel's population has had and recovered from Omicron. And an absurdity that words do not suffice, not to speak of the exponentially increased risk to inject an already recovered body. And still, school children and employees are forced to pay out of pocket for several times weekly antigen tests that have been openly admitted by health officials to be exceedingly inaccurate, and that's quite a statement compared to the potential 97% false positive PCR tests. These tests, which continue to modify behavior and hold the country hostage to enter schools, workspaces, a lengthy list of cultural activities, and our departure or return to the country depending on the rules of the day. And masks, that ubiquitous requirement, but most sinister of them all, are still required for even young children indoors. And it's a dark cloud that's descended since we covered the light of expression in our faces. It should be noted that it's all but impossible to receive an exemption. I've not heard of a single person, regardless of pre-existing condition, be successful at receiving one. One mother turned to me for help for her son who had suffered 2 blood clots unrelated to the jab, and still no doctor dared to write him one. Instead, they offer an AstraZeneca shot, the very one banned in 18 different countries. While the world was well aware, and it was openly remarked alongside Borla, the BBC, and Bibi Netanyahu that the people of Israel were, in fact, the world's laboratory, here on the ground, it remained taboo to say so. But the experiment was not only on our physical bodies, but that of a social experiment on this small, interdependent nation with the overnight installation of the Third Reich-originated medical apartheid health pass. This green pass, the population, which up to this point, and it's only increased since, was subjected to such overwhelming dissonance of morning to night, night to day, changing regulations and restrictions, one did not know what was law and what was only recommendation. Israelis believed this green pass was legislated. and summarily disinvited friends and family home, restricted the entry to hospital, university, cultural event, health clinic, and of course, in the terrific tumbling of For Your Health, threatened some people to not allow life-saving injuries if they were unjabbed. This even though our health minister, Nitzan Horowitz, was literally caught on camera saying it had no epidemiological value. And as was true already at dose three, four maniacal shots in were all under-vaccinated. A study was done by the Rupin Academy College that showed 58% of people took this injection for which they knew nothing about, had no medical indication for, didn't personally feel they need, only because of the green pass. One in four did so to keep their jobs, and a whopping 78% of newly dubbed anti-vaxxers have been vaccinated by most other and true vaccines. The story of separation of newborns from mothers, of the elderly from the family that keep their lives worth living, one that destroyed the trust between doctor and patient, co-workers and friends, and saw new recruited soldiers terrorized in the middle of the night and in the mess hall, aggressively coerced to see this jab with a stick of green pass. And though we ate next to, prayed next to, exercised next to these same people for the entire year prior, the introduction of this gene therapy jab to the staggering majority of this population did nothing to ease the fear of the injection. There's nothing to ease the fear of this infection, but rather solidified it as a permanent part of life. And it's the small crimes and quiet atrocities as they pile up from place to place that have systematically dismantled the trust, hope, and optimism that binds this country together. The green pass is like a wet cloth left in the laundry pile that's created a rot from within, whose damage, like that of the shot, continues to unfold. My first experience of understanding the power of psychological warfare, however aware one attempts to be, been surrounding the societal horror that is this green pass, as it was renamed, canceled, and reinstated. The green pass is set again to be suspended in the coming days, but it's an entirely meaningless gesture, as the Nazi-originated Enabling Act has only weeks ago been renewed in our Knesset until the end of 2022. And it gives the ruling government power to remove God-given fundamental and civil liberties with the need only to state fear of the coronavirus. In February of last year, legislation was made to allow the sharing of medical data with local municipalities and authorities. That was later retracted, but in reality, 97% of all requests by public bodies to receive data about private citizens was granted. The Israeli government gave private, sensitive information about millions of its citizens to over 250 local and other government agencies. That includes names and addresses of the ill or quarantined, test results, contact tracing, and information about vaccination status, all given without the person's knowledge or, of course, their consent. Here in Israel, as we watch surveillance system continuously placed in a blanket infrastructure across country, and as we hear of countless citizens targeted with illegal spyware, we find that we have already lost our privacy. And as our ability to withdraw cash or transfer money above small amounts without express permission is already limited, we know we are at present not in control of our possessions. So too with the signing of the Nimbus Project. The Nimbus Project is a massive 7-year project that will replace the data management infrastructure of government ministries and the IDF. One that will see the migration of the entirety of Israel's non-classified data and computerized applications, everything from government military payrolls to welfare payments to government pensions, as well as the medical files, personal and corporate tax returns of private Israeli citizens. Instead of on previous dozens of decentralized locations, it will be all in one basket in the cloud of Mordor conglomerates, Amazon and Google. And with the open bragging that the World Economic Forum has infiltrated governments worldwide, we know that outside interests have direct influence over our sovereign nations. We know the databases will continue to grow as they collect our medical information on digital passports, that 100 billion pictures are already ready for facial recognition of every person on the planet, and that our every click and like and real-life response to the social media platform algorithm leaves no aspect of the human experience too small to be collected in construction of its digital twin. This is the demolition of our world as we've known it. And while we seem to be marching toward it as if a fait accompli, I think that's one due more to images predetermined by Hollywood than God. And those in power seek to access and control ever more essential sources of life and its regenerative cycles. With a broken promise of never again, we picked up the thread of the past and find ourselves barreling down the path of destruction that will come not only to harm the whole of humanity, but to all things creeping and crawling, green and unfurling, organic, fertile life. Those of us bearing witness to these changes across the globe do so with gratitude for having the eyes to see the changes taking place. That gratitude comes equally with obligation to do all within the resources of our thoughts, actions, and will to see the continuation of creation and the human species 1.0. For the world where we maintain the sanctities of the human experience, such as the relationship between mother, father, and child, the ultimate self-determination of body, the quiet privacy of one's own mind, the sacred communion with nature and another human soul, and a world of dynamic free choice and opportunity to learn and change and do better. It's one that is yet just still within our grasp, if only we decide to do so en masse. For humans, with our inherent and ever-present flaws, can yet be an exquisite representation of our source and God. Thank you.
Thank you, Ilana. Has anyone in Israel connected the dots? Has anyone seen or even noticed that it all started in Germany again with a professor who invented the PCR test on which everything, including the vaccines, are based? Has anyone seen that the vaccine, the original vaccine, BioNTech, the technology, was again invented in Germany?
I think that the activists who are wide awake are 100% clear of the parallel. Where you have the rest, you have a very clear divide, I would say, where the rest of people, it's absolutely taboo to even say so. Certainly I myself never made any comparisons with the Holocaust or any of those things until this time, which is actually the right time to do so. Because if you, in by doing so, you raise up the memory of those martyred. To ignore it is literally to cause a second death. So I would say that with the injection of the five-year-olds, with the fourth dose, they played their hand too far, and they lost a lot. They lost a lot of they lost their audience.
Mm-hmm. So what is next? Are people beginning to understand that there's something wrong, or is the majority of the population in Israel still in line with the government, despite all the side effects, which, as it seems from what you're saying, most people don't seem to make the connection with the vaccinations?
Well, I would say that the relentless testing, I think even Bennett said this when he was at Davos, he said, well, of course we had so many positive test results, 460,000 people are testing daily. So they've pushed people too far, even 2 years in. Again, that was my point, was to say how difficult it is to accept that our government, specifically this government, would want to harm us. But there is, like Professor Desmond talked about, you have the people on this side, the people on this side, and then you have that collection of people in the middle who are angry. They're angry. They understand that a lot's been taken from them. Yeah.
Hi, Ilana. Thank you so much for your evidence. You've given us a good insight as to what is currently happening in Israel. You've mentioned a few very important points, and I want us to focus now specifically on the Pfizer contract. you have mentioned that the larger part, or quite an extensive part, of the contract between Pfizer and the Israeli government has never been released to the public. Can you once more just tell the jury as to what was the specific reason as to why the public was not invited, or basically the government not taking the public into the trust and actually say, but this is the contract that we have signed? Because obviously you've also given evidence where your government also made a very, and I will actually say, a very bizarre statement. And that is that the public's right to know is not absolute. Can you just explain that to us?
Well, because what I would say is, because we were the testing ground, there was no pretense of choice. Eventually, other countries got there, where you went from, please come and get this jab, please come and get the jab, you better come and get this jab. That came later. Here, like I said, the contract was already signed. It was already a signed, ready-to-happen deal, and Netanyahu just announced it. And keeping in line with that inability to have any informed consent or any say whatsoever, again, the contract was heavily redacted, and the Corona Committee minutes obscured and by doing so, and classified as top secret for 30 years. 30-year Confidentiality Act.
That's extremely long itself. I mean, I'm specifically thinking that if you're talking about 30 years, then the public will not know, but we're talking about the public now currently being injected with a substance correctly pointed out where they don't even, and they can't give informed consent itself. What I want to find out from you, and you have actually also mentioned FOIA applications. Is there any FOIA applications that is still in the pipeline from organizations that you are involved with, or other organizations in relation to really getting to what the crux of this mRNA vaccine agenda is in Israel?
That's along the legal lines that I personally wouldn't know if there's any plans right now. I know that there have been a laundry list of attempts to try to get the Supreme Court to honor only very belatedly, and actually it was with what I mentioned last February when they tried to allow our personal data to be given to local authorities. Only very belatedly did they even stand up in any way. So I don't know of any current FOIAs being attempted. And, okay. And because the general statement by the Supreme Court is that we can't possibly say yes or no when it comes to the world of medicine and science. Therefore, the Ministry of Health has full ability to do as they wish.
So if I also then understand you correctly, is that the Supreme Court in Israel has made a clear statement, they're not going to get involved. Are you aware of any specific cases that has basically been instituted in the Supreme Court to say, you know what, the government can't say that we don't have an absolute right. The government can't say that we have given informed consent, because obviously we don't even know what is contained within these mRNA COVID-19 vaccines. Is there any application that is currently before the Supreme Court that you are aware of?
No.
Or is it just that the lawyers in Israel, in a sense, they said, you know what, I think this is going to be a losing battle. There's no way that we will even get a hearing in the Supreme Court, which is, I believe, the highest court in the country.
Again, that's those specifics of what's been tried and what's been shot down. I know that the mask mandates and these type of things, these would really be better questions for people who are involved directly, because a lot of that happened without any news items whatsoever ever touching on it. So, but I know that they made their attempts, and even in one case that the judge was so annoyed at even having been tried that they made the lawyer pay for the entirety of the both sides of the court proceedings. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ilana.
Does that mean, Ilana, that in Israel, the judiciary doesn't function anymore?
You might be able to say it like that. There was some hope. There have been some rumblings. They were asleep largely for the first year. And I would never even dream of being able to put our hope in it, but they haven't been entirely useless for when it comes to everything that's been brought to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. Again, shocking testimony, I must say. In particular, when you see the connection between what Patrick and Matthew told us, and how this seems to be, at least at this point, invisible to a large part of the Israeli population. If it's true that Israel is like the canary in the coal mine, then we should all be extremely careful. And I think it is true because your testimony coincides with what Michael Swinwood, our colleague from Canada, says. Now we're all Indians, or what our friend from Australia said, David Cole. Now we're all Aborigines. We're all, it seems like we're all in their sights as targets. And we have to be aware of this. We also have to make this clear to the Israeli people before it's too late. Well, thank you very, very much, Ilana. Avital Livni, you have something to say to this as well, and I'm afraid it's not very positive either.
No, it's not. Hello, everyone. First of all, I'm very honored to be here. Thank you for inviting me. When the vaccinating, so-called vaccinating, I'm sorry, that's the terminology that I'm using because I'm dealing with people that use it and I have to talk to them even though I don't think of it as vaccines anymore. But when it started in Israel, soon after, I think 2 months or 3 months after, I already started hearing about people experiencing side effects, people that I know around me. The numbers went up as time went by, and I also started noticing on people on Facebook posting posts telling about what happened to them after getting the shots, and the dozens became hundreds, and yet in the Israeli media there was nothing. Everything is perfect, no side effects. And also I noticed that whenever somebody posted a post telling about what he experienced, the side effects he experienced, he immediately got comments like fake news, lies of unvaccinated people, anti-vax people. And I knew right away that the only way to stop this and to bring the truth out is only with video testimonies. Because once you see the person's face speaking from his heart about his tragedy, in your guts you know when it's not fake, you know. But all the organizations that were involved at the time with the testimonies and with collecting the details and the data, when I contacted them, they told me that it was impossible to get people to testify on camera since they were afraid. So I waited. I was hoping that somebody will do it. But eventually, when I saw that the Israeli government is not stopping, they're not going to investigate any of those reports. And on the contrary, they went full power ahead and started giving the shots to the 16 and 18-year-old teenagers. As a mother of two, I decided that I have to try and do it myself. I went inside private groups on Facebook of people who got injured from the vaccine. This was the title of the groups. And started going over, there were already thousands of testimonies there, posts, comments. I went over thousands of them and contacted hundreds of them through Messenger, introducing myself, and telling them about the project that I was going to do. But almost all of them didn't want to do it. They were too afraid to come out with their stories. And Ilana mentioned it before. You have to understand that the atmosphere in Israel since the so-called vaccination started is so violent, so toxic, a lot of hate, fear. Families are falling apart, getting divided between vaccinated and unvaccinated. And no wonder, since, as Ilana told you, our own prime minister, the incitement against the unvaccinated is unbelievable. And he was caught on camera saying at the beginning of his being prime minister, he was saying that the unvaccinated people are like people going on the street with a machine gun spraying a Delta virus all over. And as she said, he was saying when they started giving the shots to children in schools, I want the parents of the vaccinated children to fight with the parents of the unvaccinated children. So no wonder people were afraid for their jobs, of what their colleagues and friends will say, and they didn't want to come up with the stories. So in order to give them a sense of confidence and safety, I gave them my word that I will not publish anything before I have at least 40 testimonies. 3.5 months later, the project was ready. It became a heartbreaking documentary of 1 hour and 7 minutes. It was released 5 months ago, already translated to 15 different languages. Only in our website, it got more than 2 million views. And still, on the Israeli media, nothing. The majority of the Israeli people never heard of the Testimonies Project. You get the feeling that they want to shut it down. They want no one to know of the side effects. As Ilana said, there was this post of the Israeli Ministry of Health. They deleted thousands of comments of people saying what happened to them instead of reaching out to them and checking the information. And not a lot of people know, but in Israel, there is no normal system until not long ago. There was no normal effective system to collect data and reports of side effects, unlike the American VAERS. Most of the people don't even know that they should or are supposed to report. And the people from my project, when they tried to send in a report, they told me it was impossible. At the time, you had the limitation of words, and you could only choose from several side effects. So if you had something different, you couldn't put in the report. And the most important thing, no transparency. So you have no idea what happened to your report. You cannot see other reports and compare data. The whole idea of the transparency in the American system, the VAERS, is that researchers, doctors, scientists, they can go inside the data. They can do their statistics and see if there are patterns in some of the side effects that can indicate that this is probably from the vaccination, from the shot. In Israel, we are the laboratory of the world, but we don't have a system like that. And in the American VAERS, it's mostly doctors who send in their reports. In Israel, a woman from my project, her name is Esti, she got heart problems. She asked her doctor, are you going to report this? He told her, it's not my job to report. If you want, go ahead and report it. Most of the doctors are not willing even to write on the same page of the injury where they're supposed to put all the data, that this person 2 days ago had also, he got the Pfizer shot. They're not willing to write it down. So, and as I said, you have the feeling that they try to shut it down. You know, a few months ago, it's amazing. One very famous media guy is a kind of celebrity. He's not politically correct. He's saying whatever he wants. He was interviewed by one of his colleagues, and he told her, come on, let's speak honestly. You and I both know that as media people, we got instructed from the beginning not to say anything against the vaccines. He was saying it out loud. We're not allowed to talk against it. And the doctors, again. And this whole atmosphere, you know, the first thing that the people on my project felt the need to tell me when I started taking testimony, the first thing they told me, first let me tell you that I'm not anti-vax, which is the most absurd thing because they got the shot inside our body. How can anyone suspect them to be anti-vax? But the atmosphere and the incitement is so terrible that they get the need to defend themselves. And as I said, in the American verse, you're supposed, the transparency is to get the statistics. I don't have the American verse, but only from my project and from the people I spoke to, I'm not a doctor, and as a regular person, I could see patterns. I could see clear cut to different side effects. And this is, by the way, how I edited the documentary at the end. I have seven side effects. I had the heart problems, the neurological problems. These are the two major ones, vaginal bleedings and miscarriages, skin problems, blood clots, infections, and the burst of disease, usually autoimmune disease. And as soon as it was released, I saw that nobody is going to stop and investigate, and they are going to go on to the ages 12 to 16. So I soon after started another round of testimonies until today, when I try to focus on the younger cases. Unfortunately, now I see cases of teenagers and also on people who got hurt after getting the booster. And I was talking about the patterns. I can tell you of a few of them. I'm sure people, viewers that listen to us will see a few of the things similar to people they know with the heart problems. You have many disorders, pressure in the chest and strong heartbeats, irregular heartbeats, but the major severe side effects that I see is one, heart attack and cardiac arrest, and myocarditis, I have blackout, and also the cardiac arrest is mostly with people in their 40s. Every 2 or 3 days you hear in Israel about someone who went to sleep and never woke up, but of course no connection to the shots. The myocarditis, you have it especially with young men and young boys. And for the young boys, the teenagers, it's days after getting the shots, days after getting the shots. I have two cases of 15-year-old boys who got myocarditis a few days, less than a week after they got the shots. Their parents are not willing to testify. They are afraid for their jobs. But one thing that I did manage to shoot a video is about a 14-year-old boy who got heart attack less than a week after he got the shot. And by the way, he was forced by his school to get the shot because he's in a special education school, and they told the parents that if he will not get the shot, he will have to leave school. Speaking of the green passport and all the mandates, the majority of the people in Israel, there was the questionnaire, I think you spoke about it, Ilana, the majority of the people, they did, I think 6 months ago, they did a questionnaire, and around 65% of the people said that they got the shots only because of the green passport. Most of the people in my project said that they got threatened by their bosses, that if they will not get the shot, they will be fired. I have the most mind-blowing testimonies about a green passport. I shot the testimony, eventually he was too afraid to let it out. A 28-year-old man, listen carefully, he chose to take the shot because he was afraid they wouldn't let him in his own wedding. His own wedding, yes. And as a result, 2 weeks before the wedding, he got myocarditis. And he spent the whole wedding sitting on a chair. You see, it's unbelievable. Patterns, neurological, most of the people that got it, they say it started from something around the face, like ear infections, sinuses, terrible headaches. You have also a lot of cases of tinnitus, I hope I'm saying it correctly. And then it spread out down the spine with terrible aches. One of the women in the project, her name is Nirit, she said it felt like she's going in labor. The pain was so unbearable. And then it's going to the arms and legs when they say it becomes very heavy, almost numb, going up the stairs is impossible. Some of them became almost paralyzed. I have a young mother in her 30s. She spent 5 months in bed because she couldn't move. Her children fed her and gave her drinks because she couldn't lift her arm to hold the cup. 5 months. Unbelievable. And all of them, almost all of them, complain about numbing sensation in their fingers and toes, electric sensation in their veins. All of them, actually most of the people in the project, even if they get heart problems or skin problems, they complain about severe, severe fatigue. How severe? I have a young mother, Orit, her name. She's in her 30s. I asked her, what do you mean by severe fatigue? She said, I can't take my young boy out of the tub. I can't lift him up to the swing. They say that a simple activity like washing the dishes makes them, they have to lie down for 2 hours after that to recover from it. Vaginal bleedings. This is the most clear patterns. The majority of the women got strong bleeding hours after getting the shot, sometimes even just the first shot. Hours, a day, two after. Strong bleeding, usually 2 weeks with blood clots, with crunches. Sorry, excuse me for the details. I think it's important. And then they get divided to two different groups. One group that every time they get the period, it's strong, strong bleeding. And some of them even complain that it becomes earlier and earlier. A few weeks ago, I shot a new testimony. It's on our website, Leora. She now gets her period every 2 weeks. Every 2 weeks, strong, unbearable period. And the other group is the opposite. They get the first strong bleeding, and then, as they describe it, they get dried up. Once in 5 months, for three days, they say they feel like they lose their fertility. Some of them even get their blood tests as if they are going through menopause, young ladies. And the most amazing thing is that all of these side effects in the beginning of this so-called vaccination, many doctors were trying to warn people and say, listen, there are going to be certain side effects from this, from what we see. We think it's going to hurt fertility. I think you will have a lot of heart problems, myocarditis, and et cetera, and also autoimmune disease. And immediately the Israeli Ministry of Health was saying fake, fake, fake. But now they come to see that everything is becoming reality. You know, now I don't know if it's only in Israel, but we have a saying that the difference between conspiracy and reality is 6 months. This is what they say. And now, just 2 weeks ago, Ilana, I'm sure you've seen it. 2 weeks ago, the Israeli Ministry of Health, it was in the newspaper, they did a questionnaire, and they found out that after getting the booster, one out of every 10 women complained about problems in her cycle. 10% of the women. And I'm sure the numbers are higher, but let's say 10%. And now you publish it? What all the hundred thousands of young ladies, teenagers, and five-year-old girls are supposed to do with this information? Now, they say all the heart problems, no connection to the vaccination. But, surprisingly, now you start to see defibrillators, the thing that gives you, electric shock to the heart to resuscitate, in places they were never there before, like gyms, playgrounds, schools, but no connections to the shots. And even if you don't look at the patterns, only at least the testimonies on my project themselves are mind-blowing. You have Ali, he's in his 40s. He used to be a boxer, very athletic. After getting his second shot, it was on his birthday, he got a very nice present for his birthday. Hours after getting the shot, he had a very severe ear infection that got him admitted for 5 days in the hospital. After he was released, a few days after, he got a stroke. 7 months later, another stroke. And after the project was out, I'm still in contact with a lot of them, he got a third stroke. He's on wheelchair today. He has a five-year-old daughter. His whole left side is not functioning. Terrible headaches, none of the pain relievers is helping him. Nightmare. and I was talking about the autoimmune disease. Alona, a young woman, 34 years old, she got the shot only because she had to go back to the gym. Sports was her life. She was running 10 kilometers every day. To make the long story short, she got autoimmune disease. The body is attacking her muscles, dissolving them. She was 8 months in the hospital, 2 weeks ventilated and unconscious. And she was, the doctor says she's 100% handicapped. And she's 34 years old. And we were talking about the Holocaust. Not long ago, I showed a testimony of, I think, 87. She survived the Babi Yar. I don't know if you know. It's her whole family was murdered. Her whole family. And now after the booster, it might seem minor, but it's not. I'm sorry for the details, but she has diarrhea all the time. She lost 7 pounds, and she's a very small woman. She now weighs 39 kilos. She cannot leave her home. She was very active, giving lectures about the Holocaust. She's amazing. She controls all the technological things, Facebook, Zoom. She's an active, passionate woman, and now she cannot leave her home because she has to be close to her toilet, and she's losing weight every day. And she needed to take a CT test. They told her, yes, we have an available appointment in 3 months from now. She had to do it on her own expense. And there is, by the way, a difference, even though I have those patterns, I see one big difference between the testimonies of the documentary and the new testimonies. In the documentary, the testimonies were of one person injured. In the new testimonies, I have a few people injured, like somebody saying about himself, and also a few members of the family that were also injured. Yes, one of the most amazing testimonies, Estelle, her husband, her brother, and another woman from the family, all three of them died from stroke. Statistically, how can it be possible? And speaking of statistics, when they wanted to start giving the shots to the 5 to 11-year-old kids, the Israeli Ministry of Health started making Zoom sessions to parents in schools in order to tell them how safe and good it is. I got inside one of the Zooms, and once the doctor finished her presentation, I asked her, how many cases of myocarditis do you know of under the age of 16? And she told me, in the United States, according to the VAERS, where they already had the shots, I think at the time it was 1 million or 2 million children already under the age of 16, we know only of 8 cases of myocarditis. So I told her, I'm a little bit confused. Can you help me understand how can it be statistically possible that in all the United States you have 8 cases? And I myself, I'm not a doctor, I know personally 3 cases of 2 15-year-old boys with myocarditis and 1 14-year-old boy that had a heart attack. She changed the subject rapidly, and since that moment and on, there were no more questions allowed. But you see, you feel like they don't want anybody to know about it. And you know, we were talking about the green passport. I'm sorry, I have to make the correlation to the Holocaust. For me, in Israel, the most heartbreaking thing as a society is to see that Holocaust survivors cannot go in a Holocaust memorial ceremony because they don't have a green passport. In the Israeli Center Museum for the Holocaust, Yad Vashem, there is a sign that you can go in only with green passport. I can't understand it. And I'm coming to the end of my testimony, but I have to say that now in the new testimony, there is another new thing, that I see more and more cases of tumors and cancer, maybe because it takes more time. I think 2 months ago, I shot a testimony, a young woman in her 30s, her name is Hadar. A few weeks after getting the second shot, She started feeling a lump on her neck. When she went to test it, she found that she had a tumor 3.5 centimeters on her thyroid. I think 2 weeks later, she came to do a checkup again, and it was already 4.5 centimeters. And the doctors told her that it's growing in a rate of about 4 millimeters a week. And when she calculated it backwards, she saw it started exactly after she got the second shot. And in the end, they had to cut half of her thyroid to get rid of the tumor. And on the same testimony, she said that also a few weeks ago, her grandfather died also from a tumor in his lungs. It was huge, around 5 centimeters tumor. And the doctor said that this kind of tumor, it takes years for this kind of tumor to grow. But they had a CT exam from 11 months before that, and before he got the shot. And in this CT exam, his lungs were totally clear. So I don't know what kind of other explanations the doctors and the Israeli Ministry of Health would like to offer us, but it's amazing. And in the end, I have to say that besides the testimonies on the side effects, from all the testimonies, I got a lot of very disturbing other sides and very disturbing information that raises a lot of questions, other questions. For example, many of the people in the project, you can see it in their individual testimonies on our website. They said that when they got to the hospital with the side effects, the first thing that the doctors were trying to do is to admit them in the COVID section, even though they had no COVID, especially the older ones. There was one man, 85 years old, his name is Gilad. He was left in the hallway for hours. It was wintertime, freezing. They told him, listen, we're not giving you any exam until you go inside the COVID section. Why? Why is that? And since we're all here trying always to connect the dots, I'm also trying to do that in the last 6 months, to try and understand these horrific situations and things that I see. The only thing that I can connect it to, in my opinion, is, for example, a few months ago in Israel, there was a young teenager, 16-year-old boy. I think his name was Eden. He died from cardiac arrest. He got 2 shots. And on the media, they wrote that, of course, he didn't die from the vaccine. He died from a post-COVID syndrome. But his father was saying everywhere that he was never sick. I think that concludes most of it. Of course, I have a lot of stories and a lot of things to tell you, but we have a limitation of time. I encourage everybody to go into our website and to see it's in English, in other languages, and if you have questions, I will be happy to try and answer it.
Thank you very much, Avital. That's disturbing. Now, if what you're telling us, and we know that what you're telling us is it mirrors what all the other countries are experiencing after vaccination. Now, to me, it seems like they created a problem with the help of the PCR test and with the help of the vaccines, and now they're trying to create the solution by calling everything that happens after the vaccinations COVID-related or long-term COVID or whatever. I wonder what the next solution will be. But my question is, we have heard from other experts that this problem, the side effects, even though many people are trying to ignore it, the mainstream media and the governments are trying to ignore it, are trying to play it down, it is slowly but surely seeping into the mainstream. How is that happening? Through sounds ridiculous, but through, for example, the insurance companies, because all of a sudden, insurance companies, at least in the United States, but also here in Germany, are experiencing something terrible is happening. Their actuaries are telling them, you have to get rid of that risk, and some of them are trying to get rid of that risk. Is that happening? Is at least that happening in Israel, or do you not know any of the companies acting like that?
I thought about it a long time ago when it started. I said that maybe the insurance companies will save us because they will have to give the data away outside because they are losing money. But I personally, I don't know of anything. I don't know if Ilana knows, but I don't. I'm sorry. But I can tell you that many specialists said, I think that gives you the biggest, since they're not releasing any information, not about vaccinated or unvaccinated, even if you look of the total picture, of the whole picture, if you look at the total number of deaths in Israel, you can see that it's in correlation with the time of the vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
So if you had like a peak of giving the shots, a peak in, let's say, December, January, December 2020, January 2021, and now also we had in August the booster, you can see a peak in the total number of dead people in Israel. So, but we don't get the information. They don't, any question that you ask. Now, a few weeks ago, I think they got data about quiet birth and miscarriages in one of the hospitals. I think it was Rambam, that they indicate a high rate, really high rate in the number of miscarriages, but they don't give you the information of how many of them it was vaccinated women or any data. You just have the total number. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to get information.
Are people in Israel aware of the fact that the trials, the Pfizer trials, because that seems to be the most used vaccine in Israel, BioNTech, Pfizer, are people aware that these trials are a gigantic fraud, as we have learned from a whistleblower and from scientists who took a closer look?
Unfortunately, I don't think the majority of the people think it's a fraud, but the majority of the people, I think, look at it as if we tried and it's not working. Okay? It's not working since everyone in Israel now is sick. Mm-hmm. Everyone got the Omicron. Everyone. Everyone is sick. It was amazing. The streets were very empty. People, my family, a month ago, we were, me, then my child. Of course, I don't know what it is because I'm not getting tested because it's useless, but it's a kind of a flu anyway. But since everyone is sick in Israel and they see it's not working, and still you see the celebrity going on Facebook with a photo of themselves feeling very bad, and they say, I don't know, I did everything. I wore two masks. I hugged my children only from the legs, and still I got COVID. Go put your mask, go vaccinate yourself. Amazing. And some people still go on, but the good news, I think, is that the numbers are rapidly going down. The vaccination of the children in the terms of the Israeli government, it's a total failure in their eyes,
mm-hmm.
because not a lot of parents were rushing their children to get the shots.
They don't want to sacrifice their children, obviously.
Yes, but you know, they saw that they're not willing to do it. So what they have done in the beginning of this vaccination of the children, they set a new rule that when a class gets exposed to somebody who is positive, the vaccinated children can go back after one day to school with a negative test. But the unvaccinated have to stay, even if they're negative, they have to stay at home for another week or 10 days. Mm-hmm. So parents were pressured to go and vaccinate the children only in order for them not to stay at home. Mm-hmm. So they can go to work and the children will not be again isolated at home. It was amazing. So I think people are starting to be aware. I think because of the numbers of the percentage of people going to get the shots now.
You alluded to Professor Desmet, who is probably one of the best known experts in the meantime on the theory of mass formation. And he describes totalitarianism as an inherently self-destructive kind of government, if you want to call it that. Now, and that's what seems to be happening. The system seems to be collapsing. Are people beginning to see that the promises that were made are without any substance whatsoever? I mean, that is what vaccines are about. They're supposed to give you immunity, and these vaccines or so-called vaccines don't do that. Do people understand that, or do they not even know that that is what vaccines are about?
I think that I saw this interview that you made about the psychological mm-hmm. part. So first of all, they're trying to give excuses to everything. So at first, no, we have to do the green passport because we are less likely to get the disease and infected. And then they see that they get infected and then they say, okay, no. So the vaccination is good against complications of the disease. It will protect you from getting hospitalized. But they have no idea if it does work or not work. But this is what they're saying. And I think that what I heard in the interview that you made with him, if I remember correctly, he said that surprisingly, the most intellectual people are going with the narrative. And the more simple people are starting to see the truth before them. And it's true. I went to like a marketplace, open marketplace 2 weeks ago, and everyone there, you know, selling vegetables, clothes, they told me everyone is lying. Huh. Everybody's liars. Yeah, this is all nonsense. They know it, but they put their mask here just in case.
So it seems to me that the only reason why this system, not just in Israel, but in other countries as well, why the system has still not collapsed is because people buy into the lies. The system is held up by lies. That's the only thing that props it up. But it does seem to me that even in Israel, people do begin to understand that they have to ask questions. Is that true or am I mistaken?
I think it's true, but I think if we're talking about the psychological, I think because of the size of the victims, I think that they are in a stage where they start to realize that something is really wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But if they say they agree that there are side effects and there are problems in it, they will be in a very difficult state because they have to live. First of all, they feel like they were fooled, which in Israel is a very difficult feeling.
Yeah.
Israelis consider themselves to be really sharp and no one will fool them. And they, first of all, to feel that you got fooled, it's very, very difficult for Israelis. And the second thing is that once you understand what's happening with those shots, you get into a true fear of death. You feel like you have a time bomb in your body. You don't want to admit it. They say, okay, I already did it. I don't want to know about it. That's why I think, in my perspective, it's so important that we will find a kind of a cure or something to help. Because if you have the cure and you have the hope, people, it will be easier for them to admit that it was a mistake. This is what I feel.
Yeah. So
as long as there's no hope, they put their head in the sand and they say, I don't want to know about it.
So we need a real cure for the fake cure.
A real cure for the damages over the fake thing. Yes. Yes. Wow.
I'd like to throw something in at this point, Reiner, if you don't mind.
Go ahead, Pat.
I think Avital's work is absolutely the most important work that we have here now because, as you know and the lawyers know that are listening to this, we must be able to show an actual damage before you can even make a complaint. There has to be damage. It has to be documented. And it has to be emotional if you're going to present it to a jury. Her website has that. That can't be assailed. It's not her testimony. Mm-hmm. It's their testimony. Those are the people who have been injured. The other thing that's interesting, and I think that's just so critical. I thank you for your tenacity, Avital. I appreciate your tenacity, and I know that's often a characteristic of people from your country, and it's a good thing that you have that. So I'm glad. Just keep it up. Do not give up under any circumstance, and I expect that you won't. But the other thing is that the propaganda that's been pushed down from above your country level that trickles down to you, because we're getting the same propaganda you get. If this propaganda were all of a sudden stopped, the whole thing would fall apart in a matter of weeks. The propaganda is just like in a war, has to keep coming to pump up that deception in people's mind. If the propaganda chain is ever broken, the whole thing will fall apart in just a matter of weeks, and people will wake up one day and say, what on earth just happened? Mm-hmm. We've seen this in other countries and other situations, but I offer that as a key thing. The other thing is, we can't blame a doctor individually for what's happening, but the people who are controlling the top of the pyramid have created a culture of abuse that has trickled down into every hospital, into every doctor's office, into every health clinic, and every emergency clinic in the world. Now, there's a few exceptions. We know that. A few doctors are still practicing that don't buy it. But by and large, the whole thing has trickled down. It's a culture of abuse that's been created. I haven't seen this really brought up anywhere in our country yet. Okay. Who created the culture of abuse in particular, that it would end up with testimonies like what you are showing on your website? That's what I want to know, ultimately. Who created the culture of abuse? Knowingly created. This can't be an accident. There's no accident here. I don't believe it at all. But somebody at the top, we've been talking about a lot of them, I'm sure, we need to make that connection. Here's where the culture of abuse was intentionally started and passed out to all the countries in the world. Every country has somebody like we have an Anthony Fauci, the director of all things medical, to dictate policies and stuff. Where did this stuff come from? Did it come from the World Health Organization? If so, who? That's not a pun. Individually, who is the individual? So you're bringing out, you're really surfacing critical questions here, I think, and your explanation of, you know, how people are being deceived is only evidence that propaganda has done its work. That's the nature of propaganda. It's done its work. It's intended to deceive people.
Yes. Israeli Ministry of Health, I think it was published somewhere, they spend 250 million shekels. How much is it in dollars, Ilana? I think around, I don't know, 100 let's say 100 million, doesn't matter, that's a lot of Israeli money, in advertising this thing. Yeah. And it's our money, by the way, it's taxes money, okay? And if you also connect it to what I said earlier, that this media guy, he said out loud that they were instructed not to say anything about vaccination. And it's daily, it's all the time. Every show, doesn't matter what they speak about, singing, eating, go vaccinate yourself all the time. But I have to tell you that surprisingly, in the last few weeks, you see signs of truth coming out. Of course, I am very suspicious. I'm trying to understand what's behind all that, why suddenly doctors are speaking out. But you had the manager of the COVID section in the biggest hospital in Israel. He was on the news. He was saying 75 to 80%, the majority of the critical and severe cases of the COVID in my hospital are vaccinated with booster or more. He said that the most critical cases, 75 to 80%, he was saying out loud, this vaccination does not stop the complications of the disease, and vaccinated or unvaccinated, it's all the same. This is what he was saying out loud. Also there was a document of the Israeli Ministry of Health that was published long time ago, that it was written there that the masks has no medical logic. It was meant to educate the people. But I think most of the people are so busy in the everyday survival, children, bringing in the money, especially after 1 year. You know, I think we hold the medal for the most days in lockdowns. I think we had 4.5 months in total in the first year of lockdowns. Very, very strong lockdowns. Thousands of businesses went bankrupt. People lost the way to put food on the table. So they have no time to think about anything. They just did it because everybody did it. And they don't have the time to look for the information that will tell them that it was a mistake. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, thank you, Avital.
Thank you.
This is like taking a magnifying glass, looking at Israel, and realizing that this is what's happening to the entire world. Let's turn that magnifying glass or the binoculars around to get a bird's eye view of history and talk to Vera Sharaf. Vera, I know you've been listening, and we've spoken about this. It's very hard to say anything to this, but you have a different perspective because you know where it all comes from, not just from reading history books, but from having experienced it in real life.
Yes, but I'll tell you, it's extremely upsetting to hear the details of the cabal in Israel. I mean, it really is, because essentially Israel has lost its raison d'etre. The government is doing what Mengele didn't finish. I mean, this is what's going on. It's unbelievable. And people all over the world are gasping. Why Israel? Why Israel? Well, my explanation is that, damn it, Israelis, Jews, no different from others. And so when you have corrupt government, you're going to have all the corrupt elements showing up. It doesn't matter that it's Israel. The other thing is that, yes, I keep talking about history well because, of course, I was in that history, but this is really, it shouldn't be that only a witness takes history seriously. History is really how you can discern patterns, similarities. And one of the things that people come really, and I'm being besieged, I can tell you, for interviews and things. I mean, really, it's too much. But part of it is because nobody else who touches it, to make the comparison, is left standing. I mean, there's a businessman who has 3 breweries in Brooklyn, and he put on whatever, Twitter or something, made a comparison. And my God, they're ready to lynch him. He may lose his business. Well, he's going to be okay. I met with him. But the point is, his whole family were either victims or survivors. Doesn't matter. So this tells me, of course, that that is kind of a real, how should I say, that's the hot spot. They are terrified of people starting to see the parallels between the prelude and what's happening now. It's, otherwise, there wouldn't be this intensity from all kinds of both individuals and institutions. But that's not what I'm going to talk to you about today. Today I'm going to talk about something else. But first I want to just bring out that, you know, Albert Camus, the French philosopher, he said, the only means to fight the plague is honesty. Well, guess what? As we know, honesty is nowhere to be found within the corporate-dominated government and public health agencies. So for 2 years, we've all been subjected to the psychological weapons that the Nazis used to maintain a state of anxiety. I'm not so sure about, you know, the marching exactly and who it is, because one of the things that Avital mentioned, which is very true, is that the people who are most unthinking, really, or shielding themselves, you know, as ignorant, are the educated. This is very apparent, I think, all over, which ought to give us a signal that the system of education is a huge failure in terms of what we thought education should be. Because the more years you spent at an educational institution, particularly universities, somehow the less you are willing to trust your own thinking, your own critical thinking, and instead are looking for authority to tell you what you should do next. That's a very big condemnation of, you know, the educational process. What I am looking for now, what I want to talk about is, look, I mean, we've been deluged with fear-mongering propaganda now for the 2 years. And the horrific scenes of police in black uniforms brutally attacking demonstrators in European cities, in Ottawa, in Australia, and in Israel, these scenes are absolute painful reminders of the Holocaust. The objective under the Nazis and now is actually exactly the same. It is to gain control over people's lives by conditioning them to obey government directives, no matter what. Now, I want to address the pivotal role that eugenics as a hierarchical authoritarian ideology is, and it leads to genocide. That's its endgame. Eugenics was crafted and appeals to the elite segment of society. But it also appeals to the corporate oligarchs and selected government officials. And that's more important. The British eugenicists provided the theoretical foundation, which has then been used to justify social and economic inequality, to legitimize discrimination and apartheid, as well as violence against dissenters. But it was the American robber barons who provided the financial, the practical means that set in motion public policies and population control legislation. If someone can show picture one, which is the cover of Edwin Black's book, War Against the Weak. And he puts it this way. He says, eugenics was conceived at the outset of the 20th century and implemented by America's wealthiest most powerful and most learned men against the nation's most vulnerable and helpless. And that's exactly right. The American titans of industry use their influence to enact laws and discriminatory public policies that swept aside moral principles and stripped segments of the population of their civil rights and their human rights. In 1915, a joint eugenics venture was brokered by John D. Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, Alexander Graham Bell, who invented the telephone, and Mrs. E.H. Harriman, mother of the future statesman Averell Harriman. They had already consolidated their monopolies in oil, railway, steel, and the banking industries. So at this point, they sought to preserve their vast wealth and advance their interests by investing in methods to control and reduce populations. The goal of eugenics was and is to eliminate people whom the elite deemed inferior genetic material. They funded a massive lobbying campaign for the enactment of laws to sterilize those whom they deemed unfit. Sterilization laws were first enacted in 28 states in the United States. Their objective was to sterilize 10% of the American population, that was 15 million Americans. This was to be accomplished under the guise of improving public health and the human race. Number two, U.S. sterilization laws served, as you know, the model for the Nazi racial hygiene laws. For over a century, the Rockefellers have continued to be the largest financial backers and drivers of eugenics and the depopulation agenda. Number three, the ninth. Either it works. It's all right. If it doesn't work, we'll, you know, I'm used to technology. And
We have six pictures, Vera.
I know, whatever. Okay.
Let's start with the first one, then the second one, then the third one.
Okay, the third one should be the 1918 Spanish influenza.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now.
There it is.
Okay. So this is what mostly I want to talk about, the 1918 Spanish influenza. It's estimated that it killed between 50 and 100 million people worldwide. This catastrophic pandemic has been encased in a false narrative for over a century. An examination of the facts reveals a plethora of similarities between that false narrative of the pandemic in 1918 and the 2020 coronavirus pandemic. The 1918 pandemic was not, it did not emanate from Spain. It was not a flu, nor was it caused by a virus. By misidentifying it as influenza from Spain helped to conceal the true nature and origin. In 1918, as the United States entered World War I, the military was expanded to 6 million men, of whom 2 million were sent to the battlefields of Europe. Scientists at the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research, now the Rockefeller University, seized the opportunity to test an experimental vaccine on this now new available pool of human guinea pigs. Few people realize that disease killed far more soldiers on all sides than machine guns and mustard gas or anything else associated with World War I. In January 1918, an experimental meningitis vaccine made from the pus of horses was tested on soldiers. Dr. Frederick Gates, board president of the Rockefeller Institute and trustee of Rockefeller Foundation, began the experiment at Fort Riley, Kansas in January 1918. In his 1918 published report, he notes that the vaccine was given in three random spitball doses, not exactly accurate. 4,792 men received the first dose. 4,257 got the second dose. And only 3,702 received all three doses. That's a reduction of close to 23%. Dr. Gates doesn't report what happened to 1,019 men who did not show up for the third dose. Gates wrote that shortly after being injected, soldiers exhibited flu-like symptoms, including cough, vomiting, and diarrhea. The reactions, he said, simulated the onset of epidemic meningitis. But Dr. Gates brushed it aside and declared it was not actual meningitis. One wonders what science Dr. Gates relied on. Influenza outbreaks were reported at 14 of the biggest armed force training camps. Recovered troops carried and transmitted the infection to healthy soldiers in the battlefields of Europe. A 2008 report surveyed worldwide fatality and mortality rates during the pandemic. They described how bacteria rapidly spread from infected people to others, particularly in crowded settings, such as hospital wards, military camp barracks, troop ships, and mines. Now, further evidence was obtained from something like 9,000 autopsies worldwide. The autopsies proved that the 1918 flu was not a flu. According to the autopsy lung cultures, bacterial pneumonia killed at least 92.7%. When World War I ended on November 11, 1918, soldiers returned to their home, spreading the killer bacterial pneumonia worldwide. One of the most important eyewitnesses was Dr. Eleanor McBean. She witnessed the human carnage at the age of 13. She and her African-American family did not get vaccinated. They remained healthy throughout the pandemic. She became a doctor and authored several books, including The Poisoned Needle, 1957, Vaccination, The Silent Killer, 1977, and Swine Flu Exposé, 1977. She provided very vivid descriptions. I'll read a little bit. When the flu was at its peak, all the stores were closed, as well as the schools, businesses, even the hospital, as the doctors and nurses had been vaccinated and were down with the flu. Number five, no one was on the streets. It was like a ghost town. We seemed to be the only family which didn't get the flu. So my parents went from house to house doing what they could to look after the sick, as it was impossible to get a doctor. If it were possible for germs, bacteria, virus, or bacilli to cause disease, they had plenty of opportunity to attack my parents when they were spending so many hours a day in the sick rooms. But they didn't get the flu, and they didn't bring home germs to attack us children. None of our family had the flu, not even a sniffle, and it was in the winter with deep snow on the ground. Dr. McBean identified the experimental bacterial meningitis vaccine as the primary culprit. She wrote that only those who were vaccinated perished. Sound familiar?
Yes.
Can such a vaccine-generated catastrophe happen again?
No.
I think it needs to be really, really... This example is, I believe, extremely important,
yeah,
given the players. Okay, number seven. In 2018, PBS, that's public broadcasting, aired a documentary, The First Wave. The documentary fills in some of the gaps that Dr. Gates failed to disclose. We learned that by March 11th, the Fort Riley camp surgeon was confronted with the first wave of the pandemic. 100 men a day were entering the infirmary with the same malady. Some 2 million U.S. soldiers were injected with the Rockefeller experimental vaccine. It sickened them and weakened their immune system before they were shipped to Europe. Number 8, the hospital. You've seen these, I'm sure. Now, when the war ended, the Rockefeller Institute sent the deadly meningitis concoction for use in civilians in England, France, Belgium, Italy, and other Western European countries, thereby spreading the epidemic worldwide. I assume that they didn't send it to Germany because that's who they were all fighting. So maybe Germany was spared the Spanish flu. But what I want to ask, and I think that needs to be asked, is was the decision to ship the deadly vaccine abroad once they already knew what it was doing? Was it just for profit über alles, or was it part of a eugenics genocide playbook? Mm-hmm. Now, Anthony Fauci continues to cite the 1918 pandemic to generate public fear and panic of viruses. He resorts to frightening people into getting vaccinated. So in 2007, Fauci was on a fear-mongering campaign about the H5N1 avian influenza viruses. And he warned, I quote, "Heightened international alarm that an influenza pandemic may be imminent. Concern has been raised that the new pandemic, as fatal as the pandemic of 1918 or more so, could be developing." The same year, he authored an article claiming that the genetic sequencing of the entire genome of the 1918 virus has been accomplished. Dr. Fauci lied. There was no virus genome to be sequenced. In 2020, in December 2020, Fauci again raised the specter of the 1918 Spanish flu. And I read, "Coronavirus is a pandemic of historic proportions that has the potential to be as serious as the 1918 Spanish flu, in which 50 million people probably died. I think we can't deny that fact." So my question is, if a vaccine has likely killed 50 to 100 million people, the loss of those lives far outweighs any vaccination benefit. Nispa? Now, the goal of today's globalists and their planned Great Reset remains the same as it was in the 1930s. Their objective is world domination and total control of the world's natural resources, financial resources, and human resources. The global oligarchs seek to overthrow democracies and to replace them with the corporatist global model. This time, their most effective weapon is today's high-tech surveillance capabilities. The author and historian Anton Chaykin points out that, and I quote, "I.G. Farben was not only responsible for Hitler's rise to power in concert with the Rockefeller family, They became part of the elite's plan to take over the world. The current corporate takeover is the culmination of that plan and is a continuation of the eugenics program begun in the 1920s. The goal remains the same, world domination by the elites and the culling of the herd. After World War II, the global pharmaceutical colossus was a reincarnation of the IG Farben cartel pattern, which is profit before safety and the use of drugs and vaccines as a means of control. The Rockefellers continue to be the most instrumental global in the globalist plan for world domination. It's a century that they have been at the forefront. They have controlled medicine since the early 20th century. They essentially created the modern pharmaceutical empire to dispose of petrochemical waste products left over from their refining process. In the 1920s and 1930s, they financed eugenics research at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Germany. And the foundation remains one of the most influential institutions financing radical genocidal eugenics globally, including vaccines that are meant to end fertility. Their strategy is to impose global medical tyranny managed by big pharma and big tech. Now, a COVID-19 pandemic was first outlined by the Rockefeller Foundation publication in 2010. The chapter Lockstep laid out the scenario of the global pandemic quite perfectly, concluding that the only way to mitigate the global pandemic was to follow the Chinese authoritarian police state. Lockdowns was the recommended method. Now, the Rockefeller lockdown recommendation, unimaginably, was actually implemented by governments across all of Western Europe, United States, Canada, and Australia. That was, I think, a big shock to all of us, that people actually did it and complied. In April 2020, the foundation issued a blueprint for the creation of a nationwide DNA database for the entire United States population. Bill Gates, a lifelong eugenicist and a major shareholder in the business of vaccines, declared that a COVID vaccine will be the final solution. Now, you can imagine, as a survivor, I take that very seriously. One of the things that we can learn from all of this is that really they have put out in documents that anyone can read what their plans are. And most will say, oh, that's conspiracy theory. No, it's not. They're laying out and they're going according to plan. We are living at a very critical juncture in human history. We are on the brink of a totalitarian dictatorship, and this time it's global. This time there will be no rescuers. It's for us, if we don't reverse the trajectory of obediently following government dictates, we will either be annihilated or revert to the status of slaves. You can ask me anything you want, but I thought I'd throw the 1918, because I don't know that you've heard of it before, as far as the close. There are so many similarities, really, I didn't have time to. You know, I'm sure you've heard from scientists and doctors the various hazards of the vaccines, that I didn't have to do that. But this is now much more in plain sight, as I say, and I think somehow or other we have to get it across. I think that one of the things that was said previously is, you know, absolutely true. We see it with the truckers in Canada. We see it with people, working class people have not been bamboozled. Mm-hmm. They recognize, you know, that they're trying to bamboozle them, and so they're not buying it. And even if they have to wear masks to maintain their jobs, they wink and whatever and say, this is all nonsense. The problem really is the educated class, the ones that are bombarded by the upper echelon media, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and all that. That is the worst, because they really, really trust those publications. I think that we are making headway. I think that people, you know, there will be a big demonstration tomorrow in Vienna. I don't know what it will take. I just hope that there won't be again the sights that we saw, for example, in Ottawa, where a woman was trampled by a policeman's horse. But it's violence is really just beneath the surface. And I'm not sure I would really want to hear what is the best way to avert the violence from exploding.
I think that's what you're doing, Vera, exposing this. And what we are all trying to do. I think we have to follow suit. We all of us have to expose these things and have to make it clear that it's all out there in the open. Anyone can read it.
Yeah.
Anyone can read it. And it's a matter of time, I suppose, until this whole house of cards implodes. Unfortunately, however, many people will fall victim to this one way or another. And that's nothing, there's nothing we can do about it. I think that is the only way out. Exposing them, trying to get as many as possible from that 40% group who are sitting on the fence to come over to our side, not to save ourselves. We can save ourselves, but to save some of them.
The problem that, you know, that many of us, I think, have bumped into with friends, with family. I know a family in Israel, is to pull them over to read the other stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, don't listen to me. No, the answer that I got from my sister-in-law was, I trust the Department of Health. End of story.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I call this willful ignorance. And from what Avital was saying, I mean, they're kind of really shielding themselves from the inevitable, you know, as Israel was the first to jump on the bandwagon, and they're now the first, you know, doing the worst. But what will it take to get, because really, I don't know what it is that caused this kind of, like, a freezing. People freeze, and no, I don't want to look at that. I don't want to. What do you mean you don't want to look? Why not look and talk and argue? That's okay. That tells you that there is, beneath that shield of, you know, I'm trusting, you know, authority, there is this unease, I think.
Yes.
Because why wouldn't you want to get information, whatever it is?
Because it'll destroy your whole, I think that's what people are afraid of. It'll destroy your whole view of the world as you have learned it over the last 70 or 80 years. This is what Michael Swinwood, one of the attorneys who we cooperate with from Canada, says. He says, I've been lied to for 73 years. That's how old he is. And I've spoken to one of the experts today. She's a biologist, and her she understands everything, of course. And she has a sister who is a lawyer. She says, my sister understands everything as well, but that one step that she will not take, conspiracy, because that is just too much.
Yeah, I know. They don't want to, but you know, look, in the 30s, people didn't believe Hitler either.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. They didn't believe it. They just thought he was a ranting lunatic, you know, the people outside of Germany. But that's just it. I mean, a lot of it is actually foretold.
Yeah.
But people don't believe it. Okay, the problem that they have, you know, these psychopaths, is that they cannot control individuals such as us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's this. I'm sure that this is something they need to crack that nut, because they can control, we see how they can control groups, they can control whole countries, and they certainly can control heads of state, you know, with nice thick checks, but they can't predict who the individuals, you know, will be, who will not go along, and then they don't know how to intimidated us to do it, to go along anyway. But this is part of, I feel, you know, the whole eugenics model is based on really a hierarchical, you know, division, and it's of course totally arbitrary. The ones deciding are the elites who don't want, you know, don't like some, either an ethnic group or a racial group or whatever, a working class, and they decide to put them at the bottom of the heap. But individuals, really, when biology is free to do its natural selection and all that, then you can't predict. They have been trying, and you know, German psychiatry and American psychiatry have been trying for all these decades, since the 20s, to find a genetic cause for all kinds of social ailments, which they categorize as various psychological disorders, and they've never found them. That's all they're tinkering with, is genetic, and it ain't there. But that's because they want to, in other words, find that which they want to find. They don't really do real science. By the way, it was Rockefeller who funded genetic psychiatry at the institute. Yeah. They want that as, I guess, as a validation that eugenics is a science. Well, it's not.
Of course not. I would like to make a shout out for Vera having mentioned Edwin Black. And I'd like to just elaborate for 30 seconds on that. His research and the books he has written over a period of years is possibly one of the most important collections of information that we've ever had on the role of technology in the Holocaust and everything that built up to what happened in Germany. And interestingly, the original Hollerith computer was assembled, designed and assembled in the basement at Columbia University in New York City.
Uh-huh.
The basement at Hamilton Hall was given to temporary projects. They happened to like IBM, and they gave them half the basement in Hamilton Hall. And that's where they got all the brainiacs together and came up with the Hollerith computer that made its way straight into Nazi Germany ultimately.
Yeah.
And took care of all of the statistical analysis, all of the train scheduling, and just you name it, IBM was there. His work was damning, still is. The books are all available anywhere you find books. But the other half of Hamilton Hall, just interestingly enough, was occupied by the technocracy group that happened to be at at Columbia University in 1932. And they rubbed shoulders with these people.
Yeah.
And I'm sure one scientist speaks to another scientist and says, like Martin Luther King said, I have a dream. I have a vision for the future. Yeah. And here we are today talking about it, what, 900 years later. It's absolutely incredible. Thank you, Vera, for your testimony. Any of Edwin Black's books are worth reading for historical perspective.
That's right. Yep. He lays out the IBM in detail.
She does.
Thank you so much for your evidence, Mr. Shalal. I've got a following question for you. Thank you that you've actually set time aside so that you can give evidence in this grand jury. Very much appreciated. You have mentioned in your evidence that the Nazis has used exactly the same state of anxiety. And is it possible that you can actually draw some specific similarities between what you have seen and experienced during the Holocaust and what is currently happening with this COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, I was a little girl. At the time, I was 3 and a half. What I experienced was the fear that was just palpable. Everybody all the time under a state of fear. And in the camp, the fear was to be put on a list because the list was either people were sent for slave labor, or they were sent to the death camp. So this hung over, all the time. I was too young to have heard, the propaganda, the radio, and because at that time it was essentially radio. But I can tell you that Certainly the Jewish population, wherever they were in total terror. But I think that they also had the German people in fear as well, because if you didn't follow exactly what you were supposed to, someone would report you and people disappeared. There were, concentration camps in Germany, and some Germans wound up there if they said something that somebody told that they said, that sort of thing. Same thing went on in the Soviet Union. So, when you are under a totalitarian regime, you are always in a state of fear because they may change the rules all of a sudden. We had that in the lockdowns where the curfews were different. One week it was 9 o'clock, another week it was 10 mm-hmm. o'clock, that sort of thing. All of that is very calibrated and calculated.
Absolutely.
To create anxiety and fear.
Yeah.
It's to destabilize your, ability to feel secure.
So, from what you've just mentioned now, it is clear for the jury that we are actually talking about fear. They're using exactly the same kind of methods during the Holocaust. And you've mentioned in your evidence that we're talking about the propaganda that the people actually heard from the news, radio more specifically. And then you've mentioned also something very interesting where you've mentioned a list. So the people were fearful.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I can see exactly the same kind of similarity
mm-hmm.
when it comes and the evidence that we've heard today, that if you do not have a green pass in Israel, and that basically goes almost like for each and every other country that is following in lockstep, to yeah. me, that seems to be exactly the same. Will you agree with that, Mrs. Sharaf?
Yes, I do. I think that there's always the matter of degree and that sort of thing. But I think that what has been done now in the 21st century takes into account they have perfected the psychological weapons all these years. So they don't have to really be brutal. They don't have to be physical, really. And we see it because, imagine, they really have been able to impose their will on the entire Western globe, at least the Western. This is because they've perfected the method, psychology. Look, psychologists are the ones that conducted the torture at Guantanamo Bay and in Iraq. Okay, psychologists, that's really part of their business. And someone asked before, who are the ones who, you know, who can we really blame? Who caused this? Psychologists and psychiatrists have a huge contribution, if you will, to this kind of evil, because it is manipulating emotions and thoughts, and for ill, it's like for a poison. They are trying to undermine our self-assurance, our self-image, and our trust in our own judgment.
So, having regarded you are a Holocaust survivor, what is the main thing that basically stands out for you when you look at the COVID-19 landscape? And also from the stories that you've actually heard from the people who survived? Because obviously you can give us a first-hand narrative.
I do remember quite a few things. And first of all, immediately when we were chased out of our home, right, made to wear a yellow star as a sign of shame, and then deported and herded into a concentration camp and starved and all that. When I see now, they've, in different countries, they've prepared camps, which they call quarantine camps, but they're concentration camps. The Nazis demonized Jews as spreaders of disease. It was also so spreaders of disease then, and now spreader, you know, infection now. This is, they're using really even verbatim. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned before, and in other venues, one of the things that I am trying to fight against is the attempt by, I call them vigilantes, who pounce on people if they even mention the possibility that there are some parallels and that we ought to, you know, be aware of them and not go in that direction. Now, what they are doing is making the Holocaust irrelevant to history now. And that, I believe, is a far worse sin than Holocaust denial. Because they know what they're doing. They're protecting, it's as if they're protecting their fiefdom. They're putting it away in a safe deposit box, not allowed to touch the Holocaust when you're studying history. Why? I realize that the why is because if more people actually looked at it, they would recognize the similarities of the stages, the years before the gas chambers. Now, the fact that the gas chambers happened, as, you know, a Auschwitz survivor, Primo Levi, an Italian, had said, it happened, therefore it can happen again. It can happen everywhere. That's a lesson. That's an important lesson. We are still, you know, human beings didn't really change. And human beings of all groups are capable of being, you know, leaders and saints and devils. We really have to understand human nature has the capacity to, for both, for good and for evil, and we have to make choices. And when we are confronted by evil, we need to recognize it, you know, and do something about it rather than close our eyes and not see. That's the worst thing.
Mr. Sharaf, my last question to you, and seeing that you've actually drawn the parallels now, I would like to find out from you, when this pandemic started to roll out, which we actually say it's a pandemic, when was the first time you've actually started to see the similarities and say, no, to me it seems eerily similar to what I experienced as a child and what the Jewish people has experienced, and it seems like this is exactly the same trajectory that or the pathway that this COVID-19 is steering, not just now in Germany, but on a global scale. When did you start to actually see the similarities?
First of all, I looked into the idea of lockdowns and all that, and I saw that actually science said the exact opposite.
Yeah.
Never do that. There's evidence. So I realized there's something really wrong. Then the other thing, the lockdowns, what they actually did, there were a couple of things that the lockdowns did. Yes, they made people, prisoners in their home, isolate them. Isolation is the worst thing. And, of course, a lot of elderly really, really suffered. They died. But they also demolished local businesses. Well, that's the transfer of wealth. So everybody has to now use Zoom technology, Amazon. You know, only the big box stores and do everything digitally. At that time, there wasn't the digital and all that, but there certainly was house arrest and things like that where you couldn't go out and there were curfews. But once they really started to push the vaccine, and before it was even launched, before it was let out of the bag, because I think it must have been already in some warehouse before, because it was talked about so much, you know, as Gates called it, the final solution. That, and of course, that it got linked right away to a green passport. I mean, that's it. That was, yeah. That the parallel is definite. And, you know, right now, I think it was France that took back passports of people who didn't have the third shot. Well, you know, that's what Hitler did. I think it was 38 or 39 when he eliminated the passports of Jews, but that was the time that the gates were closed. Before 38, he actually encouraged Jews to leave. They just had to leave all their property. But many didn't go. Many did.
Thank you very much for your evidence, Mr. Shira.
Thank you.
Well, Vera, I want to say I'm sure glad that someone like you is still sitting in the saddle, because that is really, really encouraging. So we're not all alone here, but we have someone at our side who keeps reminding us of what this all comes from. And I think if we don't see history, history will repeat itself. That's why it's so important to see the parallels. And I think, I'm wondering, would you agree with that? Those who chose and choose to ignore the parallels, aren't they the true Holocaust deniers?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. But especially those who pounce on people who do make the connection. This has been, this is a constant. I mean, Bobby Kennedy had that happen to him, and in fact, I began to really take on whatever interviews I'm asked after an interview with Bobby in which I raised it in something, and he said, well, you can talk about that, but I can't. And I thought to myself, why not? I mean, talk clarifies. Talk is how we communicate. I mean, I don't believe in having subjects verboten. You know, mm-hmm. if somebody forbids me, then that's what I want to go and look up. Because, yeah, I finally realized that this is very important. They are doing that with the venom, and a lot of Jewish institutions are doing it, trying to prevent people from seeing the connection. Well, I'm doing that.
Mm-hmm. Mrs. Sharaf.
Yes.
Thank you so much. You remember me, the Albert Einstein quote, if I were to remain silent,
yes.
I would be guilty of complicity.
That's right. Yeah. Yes, look, that is what we have to remember. Not to be complicit by silence, because silence means we don't want to see what's happening, but it's happening. And it only gets escalated.
Well, thank you again, Vera. I think this is very powerful, and I think this will, at least for many people, make a big difference. It's a difference between someone who has heard stories and someone who has been there, who has seen it. That's why it's so powerful. And I think we have to continue doing this kind of work, all of us. And that's what I hope will inspire many more people to speak out and not to be silenced, because that's what makes the difference. That is what Professor Desmond says. We, all of us, have to keep on talking about what's really going on. We have to bring out the truth, because once we're silenced, it's all over. This will never